STR podcasts are brought to you through the generous support of people just like you. You can support these podcasts by making a gift online at str.org or by phone at 1-800-2-REASON.
Hello, my dear friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to reason. Good to have you on board. Sorry, I missed you last week. Had a good reason. My dear mother-in-law went to be with the Lord a week ago last night, which meant that I thought it better to spend the day at home around my wife. Was not a surprise. I want to say it was a long time coming, but in one sense, that wasn't true. That is, we have not been waiting for her to pass on because of an extended illness. Actually, October, she had a recurrence of a cancer that she had whipped about and maybe 10 years earlier, and it showed up in a different place, and it was pretty advanced. And so she just decided to ride it out. They gave her 6 months. She lasted five. And most of that time, she was with people she loved, family members. She was living with us for, let's see, that's 2006 to last year, so 7 years or so. Was that right? 13, 14, 8 years. And then she moved up to Seattle to the property where she was born, in the house of her other daughter, my wife's older sister, and spent the last year there, and then in the last few months encountered this problem and was quite lucid all the way to the end, and actually up until the last month was ambulatory. And this thing began to get the best of her, though, especially the last few weeks, and she quietly passed a week ago last night. One other detail: she was 96, and when I say a long time coming, that's the other sense of the word. Man, she'd been around for a long time, and she was one hearty woman. She was a very matter-of-fact, down-to-earth, nothing-buttery, hearty farm girl from Gig Harbor, Washington. I think the first time she ever saw a doctor, she was 11 years old. And just took life as it came and didn't complain. Just stepped up to the plate, so to speak, on pretty much everything, and she'd seen a lot. She was an adult during the Depression, born in 1918, tail end of the war. Her husband, Ray, who passed about 7 or 8 years ago at just a few days shy of 95 himself, he was born 3 weeks before the Titanic sank. So as a couple, they'd seen quite a bit. And it was great to have her in our home for those years, to have our daughters growing up with Grandma Trova. And when she moved out last year and moved up north, the day before she did, she mowed the lawn. That was Grandma Trova. Now, she did a great deal of the chores around the yard. My wife shared those, too, because they both love this stuff. But Grandma had the big gardens and was always out there fussing and making sure everything was right. We got a lot of trees on our property, and she would go down to the local nursery and get 25-pound bags of cow manure, steer manure, load it in the back of her car, and then she'd haul them out, drag them around the property, and deposit them where they belonged. That was Grandma Trova. And many of you have followed our family on my Facebook. And if you haven't, you're welcome to. It's not a theological site. It's just a place to showcase my family and things, just ordinary things I do day to day, because I'm an ordinary person just like everybody else. And I've had videos of Trova dragging brush and limbs here and there. And she was great. And she was just on her toes right to the almost to the very end. At 96, you know, chemotherapy is not really an option. And she was just ready to go be with the Lord, which she did. And we loved her. And many of you have sent condolences to my wife and to myself, and I thank you for that. It's very kind of you. We're doing all right. Like I said, this didn't catch us by surprise. We went up and saw Grandma Trova as soon as we found out about this, spent our Thanksgiving there. Last-minute plans, we decided on Tuesday to fly out on Wednesday. The whole family went up there. We spent almost a week there with her. And then my wife was able to go back three times later, right around Christmas for a week, and then two other weeks in January and in March. And so she actually was there up until less than a week from when Grandma passed. So my wife was able to spend a lot of time up there helping her sister Karen take care of needs and things and spend time these last days with her mom. And that was we're so thankful for that opportunity. And to our friends, by the way, who went to bat for us and for me, really, because now I got the girls, so I needed some help, especially since I was I had some traveling and some professional obligations to attend to. So we had friends of the family that took care of our girls during that time. So we're doing okay and moving forward. But I just wanted to honor my mother-in-law, Trova Laudholm Melberg, in her homecoming. What, November 4th, 19 to March 23rd, 2015. What a life. What a life. Congratulations, Grandma. Now from the sublime to the, well, not quite ridiculous, I got to tell you about, this is just more down to earth. In a sense, it's also up in the clouds in a sense too. So there's a bad pun to introduce what happened to me about a week and a half ago when I was heading to Paducah, Kentucky. Now, Paducah is a smallish town in the far west end of Kentucky, where Kentucky necks down into that little bitty section at the confluence of the Ohio River and the Mississippi River, Paducah, Kentucky. It's a great little town. A quilting, center or capital of the country, I think. They have, in a couple of weeks, they have a big quilting conference, and there are going to be 30,000 people that descend on Paducah, Kentucky. I don't know how they're going to get there because there's very few flights in and out, and this is what I learned, and I'll tell you about this in a moment. But I think that's more than the population of Paducah. I don't know. Maybe I'm mistaken. But it's a cool place to go visit, but it's hard to get to. And I found that out a week ago Friday because I was scheduled to speak Friday night at an event for this church that was somewhat of an outreach event. So not only were church members going to be there, but there were going to be, of course, a lot of people that were invited to hear what I had to say. I think I talked about the problem of evil. And then the next day, a conference where a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours, where I talked about other topics than Sunday morning. Again, another one at their service. And then the ambassador talk, I think, I gave. So I had a whole weekend with these fine people. But it was getting there that was a problem. Because I have an event on Friday night, and usually if I have a Friday night event, it's just too risky to fly very far on that day because you could miss a connection, right? That happens. And then not make it in time for the event. And so usually I fly out the day before if I have a Friday event, especially if it's west, or rather east of the Mississippi. But in this case, it was just a couple miles east of the Mississippi. So we took a chance, scheduled a 6 a.m. flight out of LAX. And you figure, well, that's the first one in the morning, right? What could go wrong? I had to get up at 2:45 in the morning in order to get ready and to get out of my place in Thousand Oaks to be in Conejo Valley area to get to the airport on time to catch my 6 a.m. flight. And at 5:20, when I'm queuing up to get load up, all of a sudden they declare a delay. Now, I had about an hour and 40-minute layover in O'Hare in Chicago, and I thought, that's going to be safe, right? What can go wrong? Well, we ended up being delayed about a half hour getting on the plane. Okay, that's not so bad. And then we sat there, and we sat, and the flight recorder went out. Then they got a new one, and that didn't work. So then they got a new one, and then something else happened, and we sat. And then when you sit for a while at LAX, you lose your place in the queue, and you got to wait to get plugged in so you can take off. And the time is ticking away. Now, I was trying to be prescient given the problem of connecting flights because my flight, an hour and 40 minutes out after I was to arrive in O'Hare to Paducah, Kentucky, was the only flight out that would get me to my destination in time, at least to Paducah. So I went upstairs and I talked to the gal there who was handling, you know, reservations because I had an hour delay. So I used that time to set up alternates. And I got another flight that would connect me into Nashville, which was a two-hour drive from Paducah. Okay, I got that squared away. If I missed the first one, I can catch the next one, which left about a half hour later. Now, that meant our friends in Paducah would have to leave Paducah, Kentucky, before I landed in Chicago so they can get to Nashville in time to pick me up and get me back in time for the event at 7 o'clock. Thought I had it all covered. And then I'm sitting there on the tarmac texting the enforcer back and forth as time is going on, and the enforcer's scrambling looking for other options, and the folks at Paducah are scrambling looking for other options, I realized I was going to miss my Paducah flight. No worries, I still got another flight into Nashville, and then I missed that flight. I'm doing the math, right? You know, I know how long it takes to fly to Chicago. It's over with. And I got in the air with no confidence that I would be able to get to Paducah. Well, how was I? We checked every single town, St. Louis, Memphis, Nashville, Little Bittyburgs in southern Illinois and southern Indiana, anything. No luck. I landed in Chicago, and there was a text from the enforcer, an email, actually. We got a plane for you. So let me tell you what happened. While the enforcer was talking with our friends in Paducah, she just, after every single thing dried up, in fact, what they were thinking about doing was having me go to the United Club there in Chicago at O'Hare and find a quiet little conference room and then Skype my talk to this audience that was going to show up on Friday night. We had no other choice. And Melinda just happened to say offhandedly, well, gosh, you know anybody with an airplane? And as it turned out, the day before, the pastor was having lunch with one of the church members who was a bit of a captain of industry in that neck of the woods. He's got some pretty big operations there and a small operation with a handful of airplanes. And he said the day before to the pastor, by the way, as he was leaving lunch, if you ever get in a bind and you need a private plane for an emergency, give me a call. Can you believe that? Less than 24 hours later, Charles was on the phone cashing in that favor. And when I got to Chicago, I saw the email, hopped into a cab, grabbed my bags, hopped into a cab, scooted across town against really bad Chicago traffic, by the way, to Midway Airport, and there sitting on the tarmac waiting for me was a beautiful turboprop plane. I'm talking first class all the way with the stairs down. I felt like the president of the United States, you know, walking up those things just for me. Didn't cost the church anything. It was a favor. And my pilot, Burke, had flown up from Paducah, landed there on one of the private runways section of the of Midway. And as my cab dropped me off, there's that beautiful plane sitting there. And no TSA, nothing like that. I just walked through the lobby, yelled Burke's name. He said, here I am. And out we went and right up the stairs. And I'm flying in style, I'm telling you. I said, where you want me to sit? Because there's all these leather seats, like four, five, six seats in the back. You know, it's a nice private plane. He said, sit wherever you want. I said, I want to sit up with you. So I climbed into that real tight little cockpit seat, put on my headset, and off we went. and had a grand time. So it's just an amazing story. I was upset for a good portion of that morning, but I had to battle that because when you travel a lot, you know this happens. You just run into trouble at one end, and you miss your connection on the other end, and that really messes things up. And we don't like to do that. We don't want to. I don't think I've ever missed an event. Melinda, have I ever? I don't think I've ever missed an event because of airplane. But we've scrambled a lot. I've missed coming home because of that. I've had to stay over in Houston and some other places overnight because I missed connections, but not an event. And that matters to us. And so it was. I was nervous, even though we were doing everything we could to cover the bases. I was nervous, and I was thinking, I'm going to miss that flight. Well, maybe I'll make the next flight. I'm going to miss that. These doggone people, why don't they get their planes squared away? I mean, this is my temptation, right? And finally, I said, you know what? Let's just put this in God's hands. And here's what matters. It does not matter whether I get off the ground on time. It does not matter if I catch that flight to Paducah or to Nashville, which I missed both of those. What matters is I show up at the event on time. That's what matters. And I don't know how God is going to get me there, but as long as he can get me there on time, that's what I care about, not any particular way that happens. And God worked it out, didn't he? Now, there are lots of times where I look at the circumstances and they kind of fall together in, let's just call it, more natural ways. And I'm thankful that God did this or that or whatever and worked it out that I make my flight and I'm running through the airport. And there he is. They're closing the door and they let me in and it works out. So thank God for that. But once in a while, something like this happens that just has God's fingerprints on it, right? In a more dramatic way. And let's just say that's nice when that happens. You know what I'm talking about. God just shows up the day before. And a guy says, if you need a plane, I got one. And there within 24 hours, he had to cash that in. So my thanks to the good people in Paducah, Kentucky, and they are good people, and I had a fabulous time. And it looks like we're going to schedule something again for next year. Incidentally, I was on Friday night and Saturday morning, and when I flew that plane down, I ended up landing. I met the plane at 4 o'clock, and we landed at 5:15 in Paducah. No, 5:30 in Paducah. Plenty of time to make it. And that was almost as fast as taking the commercial carrier. It really was. Because we were flying at 24,000 feet, 300-plus miles an hour. I mean, that's pretty good. So that was great, but Saturday afternoon, I had the afternoon off, and these great people put me to connected me with a fishing guide, and they got me out there on Lake Barkley, and I did some bass fishing, caught a 4-pounder, among others. That was my biggest, so I had a great time with these guys. That was great. So my thanks to the good people in Paducah, especially the businessman who lent us his plane, and also to Melinda for the great ground game that she put together here to make this happen. We had a great team here. And a special thanks to God for showing up in the particular way that he did that day. That was sweet. All right, let's take a quick break. Lots of folks to talk to on the phone. I'll do that in a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. You're listening to Stand to Reason.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel back at you here on Stand to Reason. You know, I mentioned about my escapade a week and a half ago, and actually I just got back 2 days ago from another town, a much smaller town actually, Baker City, Oregon. You ever hear of that? I had to fly into Boise and then take a two-hour drive into Oregon to this great little cattle town, actually, in a mining region. There are old mines all over the place, met with the Baptist church there and did some work with them. And again, sensational group of people. Smaller group, there's only about 100 people or 120 people in the entire church, but didn't matter to me. I was glad to be able to be with these good people and make my contribution. But I encountered something in Baker City, Oregon, that I have never encountered before in a church. They actually had a mission trip fundraiser. Okay, now that happens, right? And sometimes you raffle something off. And that's how you raise your funds for your enterprise. And you can raffle off a study Bible, or maybe you can raffle off an iPad or something like that, an iPod, you know. You know what they were raffling off to raise money for missions? A brand spanking new Colt 45 1911 Combat Elite. There it is. It looks like a Jack Special here, man. Look at that gun. That's pretty. The drawing will be held April 6th, $25 per ticket or $100 for five tickets. Only 175 tickets will be sold. Man, those are good odds. That's a pretty gun. What church raffles off a gun? A handgun. To raise money for missions. I thought to myself, that's my kind of church. I like that. All right. Well, let's go to phones here, and let's go Orlando, Florida, and Brett. Hello, Brett. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. You're anticipating my commentary for the second hour. I didn't get to it at the beginning with your question, but I don't mind.
I figured,
I don't mind getting into it a little bit with you.
Yeah. It was funny. I figured that would be top of your list. So
I had these other things that were a little more pressing. I wanted to resolve, about Grandma Trova and then the good people in Paducah. That was an interesting story, but I was planning to get to this next. So go ahead.
Well, you're probably way ahead of me on this one, but I actually just kind of wanted to get your thoughts and see if this struck you as ironic as it did to me, but. Part of the drama with this RFRA, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act,
in the state of Indiana, right? That's what your question was about. I knew you knew, but we hadn't announced it to the callers yet. So
yeah, so part of the drama that's been kind of interesting to me has been the response from a lot of prominent businesses that are operating within Indiana.
Yeah,
a couple of which were like Angie's List and a few other pretty notable ones that, and the response was kind of interesting, and I was curious if the irony was just on me or what, but basically they were saying their objection to it was that they were going to either not expand business within Indiana until this law is repealed,
or
there were some major events saying we're not going to do business in Indiana until this law is repealed. But the irony to me seemed odd that they would say, you're asking us as a business to do something immoral, therefore we're refusing to do business. And they're doing this in objection to a law that basically, in principle, is the exact same thing, which is that you have the right as a business to refuse business if you're asked to do something immoral. So I don't know.
Well, if you're asked to do something that violated your religious convictions, right?
Yeah, at least in essence.
They call it the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, RFRA.
Right.
So, just for a point of information, it's not about broad morality. Like, we don't think that's right. But this is you have to have a religiously grounded conviction about something that you are that you want to avoid doing in virtue of that conviction. So it's much more narrow even than what you said. But this isn't the way it's being treated, and I think it is ironic that here is a law that is being passed to protect business, and businesses are getting their, you know, their trying to find a nice way to put it. They're getting upset about this, and so then they are declaring they are going to curtail their own business voluntarily, which is so weird. I don't take any of that seriously personally. To me, this is just all a bunch of saber rattling, because I do not believe that these folk are going to quote unquote follow their conscience, which, by the way, is misapplied in, given the particular nature of this law, which has been wildly misrepresented. But I don't think they're going to follow it if it's going to cost them a lot of money, period. I think this is just saber rattling and threats. And these people have bottom lines. You know, they've got shareholders. They got all kinds of other things. You want to pull out of Indiana? You know, come on. You know, somebody might cancel a trip next week, but they're, you know, they're not going to, it isn't like Indiana is going to disappear from the face of the earth because of this serious crime they've committed. And and for the mayor of Connecticut to essentially declare economic war on another state is, I mean, it's almost laughable. It really is.
Yeah.
It's just silly.
Yeah. It was funny. It just seemed like the outrage was a few yards ahead of their sense of irony, you know.
Yeah,
just at least in principle that, you know,
they're going to cut off
in the essence of it. They're you can't really object to it.
No,
in
of
this
course
way
not.
Affirming it's the
same
the
as
wisdom
the,
of it, you know,
yes,
which is that you
course.
Shouldn't be forced to do something.
Listen, there are 20, you know? What, 20 other states that have the same thing? I'm just looking. Bill
exactly.
Clinton signed a federal law almost identical to it into law in 1993, and oh, for goodness sakes, you know, this is much ado about nothing. But it does tell you a lot about the cultural ethos, particularly of the elite, of the leftist elite. And I'm using the term not pejoratively, but I'm using it descriptively. I do think it's pejorative, partly because they've earned the contempt for the way that they've conducted themselves. But I'm just using it descriptively. This is the political left, and this is the way they work. And I've said many, many, many times that the left, generally speaking, wherever they've shown up in the world, they have a totalitarian impulse. And for them, it's my way or the highway. And it would be nice if we could characterize this charitably as an issue of conscience with them. But it is not, because this is not about bigotry and it's not about intolerance. Well, let me back up for a minute. Actually, it is about bigotry and it is about intolerance. Theirs.
Right.
Not those on the right. And I'll have more to say about this next hour, but all of their self-righteous posturing cannot be taken seriously because of the way they are comporting themselves on this, the way they are distorting the facts on this, the way that they are, you know, flip-flopping around. Even Hillary Clinton, who now is a de facto presidential candidate, so she's going to weigh in with a tweet about this. The irony is that she opposed same-sex marriage until March 2013. This is March 2015, 2 years ago.
Right.
And now she's got her, righteous indignation regarding this thing. When it perfectly mirrors a law that her husband signed, a federal law that's her husband signed into law in 1993, and now she's got her dander up about this. It's just all political posturing. I shouldn't say all. In her case, it is. But the rest of them, it's disingenuous, wounded sense of morality. It's disingenuous entirely, because they are just as intolerant and vicious, really, as anybody else that they're accusing. Go ahead. Sorry.
It makes me think, you know, whenever if you decide to do an update to your tactics book, it might might be a good one, just given the state of politics in general, to do a chapter on demagoguery.
Just
as its own, chapter
own,
to
own
you know
issue,
how
because right.
it's sort of like the grand. It's sort of like how it encompasses every one of your other tactics into one, and how they're able to just bludgeon you with. I mean, it just takes you so much longer to explain why they're wrong, and then they're on to the next subject.
Well, see, this is part of the thing. This is demagogic patterns here are kind of like a steamroller and suicide tactic worked in together. They're going to roll over the top of you with their point of view that turns out to be compromised by practical suicide. That is, they are doing in spades the exact thing that they are complaining that they think is being done to them. It's not being done to them, but they say it is, and so therefore they're going to retaliate way over the top. You know, they're going to drop the bomb on Hiroshima for a small infraction, or what appears to be a small infraction.
Even the potential in this case. There's nothing has even happened, which is the funny thing, is that they're restricting freedom before there's ever been an offense.
Yes, that's right. Now,
which is very odd, given that it's so against the classical term of liberal. Liberal view, it's so opposite of
that's
that.
That's right.
It's so interesting.
Yeah, that would be a John Kennedy liberal. But see, the times have changed in the last 50 years, and the word liberal has come to be synonymous with leftist. And when I say infraction, you're right about this. There's not been a legal infraction regarding these things or a case that's come up. Even in the other states that have this, it's almost never adjudicated because it just almost never comes up. But I'll tell more about this in the beginning of next hour. But the infraction that I was referring to was the infraction of the audacity of any government to pass a religious freedom law that would give them any protections that might be construed as an affront to homosexuality and same-sex marriage. That isn't even the purpose of this. It has a different purpose entirely, and the way it's played out is entirely different. But anyway, they construe it that way, and that's the infraction. How dare you even countenance a Religious Freedom Act that might be characterized or might be pressed into service regarding something that touches on the question of homosexuality. And for this, they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima. That's the point that I'm making. It's methinks thou dost protest too much, you know? What else is going on here? And they're just showing their totalitarian hand. This is a mob action. This is bullying. It is steamroller to the max. And it is a grotesque miscarriage of the truth. Because the charges and challenges that are being offered regarding this are just simply inaccurate with regards to the laws themselves.
Yeah.
So one wonders what's motivating them.
I won't keep you on here. I know you probably have a lot more, and so I'll keep my ears open, download the podcast.
All right, good.
Special request, though, from a longtime listener. If you ever do a DVD version of Decision-Making in the Will of God, you'll have a very happy listener.
Well, we just did one, Brett.
No kidding.
Yes, we did. See, what we're doing, and this is a good time to give you a promo on this. We just refreshed the entire ABC series. It used to be 18 titles. I'm sorry, it used to be 15 titles, three packets A, B, C, five titles each. We have expanded that to 18 titles. We've removed some duds or some things that we didn't think were as important as now as maybe they were then. And we have added some things, like, for example, I added truth is not ice cream, faith is not wishing. I've added the Credo talk. I've added contend earnestly for the faith. I just finished the atheism talk yesterday, atheism bumping into reality. So it's a variation of my naturalism talk. And that went an hour and a half. So in these cases, since we have an audience that is gathered just for the refreshment of these series, I'm not constrained by time like it would be for a 45-minute sermon or something. And so I do my thing. And sometimes it's an hour, sometimes it's an hour and 15 minutes. In a couple of cases, it's an hour and 30 minutes like last night. But one evening, I did two sessions, two longish sessions on decision making and the will of God, and everything is being videotaped in HD.
Awesome. Oh, that makes my day.
And so we'll have a DVD version and a CD version of this.
Oh, that's awesome. We've had some very patient classes that have gone through the audio, and they've been very good sports about it. But I can tell they were hurting for a visual.
Oh, so, yeah. Well, okay.
That's going to be great. That's awesome.
Well, I'm glad to hear that you're looking forward to that. And the word is that the whole set will be available by the end of the year. I've got all the teaching done. They just have the production work to do now. They're editing and we just want to do a good job on this. So we're going to be releasing them one by one. So they're going to finish the A's first and then work on the B's so we can get the A out there. And
great.
I think decision making is in the B's. Pretty sure, and then we have the C also. So anyway, it's on the list here. We're working on it.
Great.
Okay.
Well, thanks, Greg.
Okay, Brett, I appreciate your call. Thanks so much. Let's go to a quick early break, and we'll come back to more of your calls on Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe to STR's monthly publications, Solid Ground and Greg's Mentoring Letter. Just go to str.org and click on the subscription button at the top of the page. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. We'll send you the bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, that Greg Kokel writes on an in-depth subject, free for a year. We'll also send you his bi-monthly mentoring letter that he writes on practical skills you need to be an ambassador for Christ. These are no ordinary newsletters. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ for free. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like why the Bible is reliable, evolution, abortion, timely issues so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador for Christ on key issues you will be challenged on. You can go to str.org, subscribe to the e-news to receive Solid Ground and the mentoring letter.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
Back to you here on Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host, and I just mentioned that the ABCs are going to be re-released this year, not only in CD, all new refreshed talks, everything brought up to date. To my notes, many of those talks from the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, go back to before we started Stand to Reason, which is almost 22 years ago now. And when I was a staff pastor at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. So, those things needed to be refreshed. I had a squeaky voice back then, I think, and so I'm doing better on that now. But that reminds me, though, that the Bible Fast Forward, which we released a couple of years ago, eight 50-minute sessions of a theological overview, really, of the Scriptures to give you the big picture in a theologically a granular way. I mean, you're going to get some substance here, right? Starting with the fall and then moving through the covenants, the Abrahamic covenant, the Mosaic covenant, the New Covenant in particular, the foundational covenants that govern the New Testament theology, and then coming to the time of Jesus and the advent of Christ and how those things all came together in his life. That's the Bible Fast Forward. 8 50-minute segments and, 150-page workbook that that covers all the material. So it's very comprehensive. And that is now available for HD streaming and downloading, so you can get it either way. It's HD quality. You'll save some money because it's virtual, and you'll get it instantly, right? And you can watch it on your mobile device, your TV, your Roku, Apple TV. You just go to the SDR store, and when you come to that product, the Bible Fast Forward, just click the orange download button, and it's yours, all right? Let's see what Darren has to say here in Indiana. Another Indiana call. Darren, welcome.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
The question I wanted to ask is having to do with the problem of evil in the world. I've been trying to think through and do some reading on this topic as of late. I think it, at least at a popular level, seems to be one of the arguments of choice against some of theism, and
right.
in particular Christian theism.
Right.
And one issue that has, I haven't seen this directly written or addressed, but it's at least enough that it's formulating in my mind, is, I try and lay it out like this, that firstly, it is more absolutely or purely good for a mind to not have thoughts about evil than to have them. And then secondly, but God in some way must have had some thought or something related to that, to evil, when at the point or even before the point of creation, he knew that evil would exist. He knew the choices that would be made. And so therefore, God cannot be
right.
ultimately and absolutely good. And
okay.
I think that so it challenges the moral argument and also maybe even an existence of God type argument for
Does, the way you put it, it means to raise that question because it seems to suggest a different type of conflict or incoherence with the idea that there is a God that is perfectly morally good and there is evil in the world. It's a different angle on that. But I think there's a mistake here in the way you're formulating it, you're thinking about it, which makes it sound more compelling than it actually is. So let me ask you this. Is there a difference in your mind between thinking adulterous thoughts and thinking about adultery? I could clarify if you like. When I say thinking
sure.
adulterous thoughts, that means you are entertaining amorous fantasies of an adulterous nature.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second case, you are one who is thinking about adultery as a thing, as a sin, as an action, as a behavior, whatever.
I see.
Is that a fair distinction?
Yes, I think I see what you're saying.
Okay, so it seems the first would be morally suspect, but the second wouldn't be. You could be a perfectly pure person, and be thinking that person is in an adulterous relationship that is wrong. Okay, there'd be no moral compromise in thinking such a thing. So let's go back to your first premise. I wrote down, more purely good. Oh, it would be more purely good not to have thoughts, the way you put it, where it was about evil. And I don't, if that's the case, that premise isn't true in my view. It would be more purely good not to have any evil thoughts. Okay, but having a thought about evil would not be the same as having an evil thought.
Okay.
So I think we could say that God is certainly capable of not having evil thoughts, even though he has thoughts about evil. Is that fair?
Okay. Yeah, I see that distinction. That's a good clarification.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that my impulse was to think there must. I saw it fairly quickly, but my impulse was to think there must be something wrong with the configuration, because if this was the case, if your argument, as you put it, went through, then this would mean that the notion that there's a perfectly good God is contradictory. But if there is no perfectly good God, then we lose the only legitimate and rational foundation for objective morality anyway. So the whole question about evil becomes moot. You can't have evil unless you have violations of an absolutely good law. And evil isn't just a violation of some kind of abstract law, but rather the obligations that we ought to keep but we don't are held between persons. So in some mm-hmm. sense, there has to be a morally perfect being that grounds moral obligations, if we're to have any obligations at all. And then we appear to, or else there wouldn't be any problem of evil.
Right.
So it's almost like, gosh, there must be something wrong about what you said, because that would render the entire discussion almost incoherent, but it seems to be very coherent. And I think the distinction I pointed out just kind of saves the moral argument without too much difficulty.
Right. Yeah, I knew I was missing the distinction somewhere, because recognize that without God there is no moral standard, mm-hmm. And want to be prepared to answer those.
Yeah, no transcendent moral standard. No standard adequate. Here's the way I want to put it, just to be careful with people who are listening carefully to me. You can have standards, but they're all subjectivistic standards. They're
right.
Mind dependent upon the minds of the people conjuring them. And but those kinds of standards are not adequate to ground the problem of evil. So that means evil is just doing something I don't agree with, but that's
right.
Petty. Okay. So there has to be a transcendent standard of good, to make sense out of objective evil, which is necessary to be in place before the problem of evil is a real problem. These
sure.
are all kind of joined at the hip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
Good. All righty?
Yes, thank you very much.
All right, Darren, it's good talking to you. I appreciate your call. We have time to get to Mike in Columbus, Indiana. I said our second Indiana call, but that was actually our first, and this is our second Indiana call. Hey, Mike, welcome.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Good. I'm doing well. Yeah.
So you're in the
beleaguered. This must be the Hoosier edition of STR.
State. Yes, right. You're in the beleaguered state again. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So what's on your mind?
Yeah, I wanted to talk about the legislation that was passed that
right.
the caller, two callers ago, was talking about.
Right.
The
anti-gay bill, right?
Well,
that's the way it's been characterized.
There's no mention of that in the bill. Obviously.
No, of course not.
It's been widely misreported what the bill actually says.
Yes.
And one of the things that I noticed is just how quickly everything spread on social media. So, and I have a lot of Christian friends on social media, obviously.
Yeah.
And the number of people, it was almost like a knee jerk. Hey, I'm a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a bad idea, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
From a lot of my Christian friends, and mm-hmm. I was kind of taken aback at that. And one quote in particular that I saw that kind of got my attention was somebody, a guy that's fairly intellectual, and he and I have a lot of discussions. Was taking the basically a quote of Jesus and kind of turning it around,
uh-huh.
and saying if a gay person asks, or there are those that say a gay person you should not bake a cake for a gay person, but I tell you, if a gay person asks you to bake a cake, bake them two cakes. It was
yeah.
kind of the twist on the
sure
on the quote. Right.
Or how about this? Oh, this is good. So some people say that you should not marry two gay persons. And I say to you, if someone asks you to marry two gay persons, marry four gay persons. Yeah. Or four persons. So yeah. I'm trying to get the polyamory in there somehow in a clever way. No, Jesus is not going to do something that is immoral.
Right.
And of course, we're not talking really about baking a cake. And if he, no, this is never an issue. No one has ever
right.
said, no, get out of my bakery. I mean, this isn't the issue at all. You know, you mentioned, I'm a little surprised at what you said about the Christians and their response here. It brought to mind immediately the first Columbo question. So when somebody says, well, that's a bad idea, I'm going to say, what is a bad idea? What exactly is? Well, this law. Well, tell me what about the law is a bad idea? And I saw details on this. I'm getting a lot of rattling in the background there.
Oh,
I don't know. It's
sorry.
Really loud on
yeah.
my end. I don't know about you, but
yeah,
when I saw this on the when I came to the airport and saw the headlines of this on Friday in Chicago, I guess is where I first saw it. And I was looking. Here's the first thought that came in my mind. I saw all the blah blah blah. Everybody screaming bloody murder. And here's what came to my mind. What does the law say? What
yeah,
does the law say? And I promise you, as I sat there asking the question, I didn't have time. I'm reading the first couple of paragraphs. Of course, you're never going to get the important information in any of these highly editorialized front page pieces. You're going to get all of this stuff, this narrative nonsense that it ought to be on the op-ed page. But that's our first Columbo question. What do you mean by that? So in a circumstance like this, it's a bad idea. What exactly is a bad idea? That law. What about the law is a bad idea? Well, you know, I don't know. I didn't read the law. I just read the LA Times and the New York Times,
yeah.
the Washington Post.
Well, maybe, I saw a picture come across my Facebook feed that equated it with denying African-American service in the South back in the 60s.
Yes, that's right. It's just nonsense. So if a person, I thought, I better see the wording before I pass any judgment for again, you know, I can't come on the air and say that's bad, bad, bad if I have no idea what's in it. I'd have an idea
right.
what's in it. It's the exact same thing virtually that was passed not only in the 1993 federal bill that was signed by Bill Clinton and passed, what was the count? Some ridiculous majority. Passed it, but not only that, but it's the same law that now with Indiana, 20 states have on their books, including, by the way, the state of Connecticut,
mm-hmm. which has the governor who's yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, come on.
Now, well, there is one criticism I've heard of it that does hold a little bit of water, and that is the last. There's a piece at the very end of the legislation that is a little bit different than some of the other mm-hmm. other laws. But there are some states that have an even more binding, or even a little more harsh. I guess use the word harsh,
right?
A harsher stance than the law in Indiana.
Yeah,
but
more,
Mike Pence today had a press conference saying that he was going to that they were looking at changing the wording of the bill to help placate some of those criticisms, but
right,
I think
right.
that might be going down the. You know, they're not looking for reason being reasonable.
Yes. Now
the critics of it.
Let me ask you a question, though. Do we see anything, any suggestion or hint in anywhere in the Bill of Rights about protections for sexual behavior?
No.
Nothing. Do we have protections regarding religious belief?
Yes.
It's the first freedom. It's the very
right.
first thing.
Yeah.
So if there's any imbalance here, it ought to be in virtue of religious freedom, not in virtue of some other religious freedom. That is, if people want to say no because of moral convictions or rather religious convictions, they should be free to do that. And if somebody else gets the short shrift on it, well, they can have their needs fulfilled in a different way. But the first freedom, the religious freedom, is the most important freedom. This is why it's first, called a first freedom, for goodness sake.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just a first freedom like the first five, but it's the first of the five, and it's the first freedom.
Right.
And which means it ought to be the the tie ought to go to the first freedom, not to the individual freedom, if indeed that's what's in question. But of course, you know, the tide has turned on that issue. And so now you have to have laws like this. And by the way, these are referred to as RFRAs. Okay. Do you know what that acronym stands for? Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Religious Freedom Restoration Act. This reminds me of kind of like a baby born alive act, you know. If the baby is, if your child is scheduled for an abortion, you try to abort, the baby is born alive. Why do we need a special bill protecting that life? You know what I'm saying? Isn't like just our basic law system adequate? You can't kill a living baby. But so we've gotten to the point now where our foundational laws and principles and the like are no longer protected enough. We have to pass special legislation to restore the protections that seem to be inherent in the basic Bill of Rights. And so now you have to have a baby born alive act, and now you have to have a Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you know. So, you know, things are desperately wrong if we've got to have these acts. And then the world comes unglued because we've tried to restore a semblance of first freedoms that should be the freedom for everybody, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I think what this is telling me is there's a lot of big changes coming, and they're not looking good for those of faith.
Right. Well, those changes have already come, and they're all being played out right now. In fact, this is one of the applications I'm going to make in the next segment about this law, that that this is just another step of a number of them that we've already taken as a culture down this road of bigotry and intolerance. And I'm using my words advisedly. This is the road of bigotry, bullying, and intolerance from the left. I mean, if that Brendan Eich can get pushed out of Mozilla, which he helped found just because he gave money to a political cause, and he gets fired, and the police chief there in Atlanta gets fired because he wrote a religious book that has a page in it identifying homosexuality as a sin, so he gets fired for his discrimination. There's no discrimination there. It's a voicing of an opinion. What happened to first freedoms? Come on. Anyway, thank you for the call, Mike, in Columbus, Indiana. Hang in there, and for the rest of you in Indiana. And coming up next segment, I'm going to talk a little bit more detail about this Religious Freedom Restoration Act and the contradictions bound up in the hullabaloo mob action against it. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason. Hang on. Hello, my friends, and glad to have you with me here on Stand to Reason. We touched on last hour some of the details of this thing I want to talk about now, and that is what's going on in Indiana and really all over the country with regards to what happened in Indiana, I guess, last week. And, you know, sometimes I'm a little Johnny-come-lately on these things because I am not riveted to the news. I do not watch the news. I do not read newspapers or weekly magazines or any of that stuff. What happens is I get my information from the internet, from my team, who passes things on to me that they think are relevant. I do listen to some talk shows on occasion. Many of you know I listen to Dennis Prager. I think he's an even-handed, fair-minded guy. We share a lot of the same views, obviously, with regards to religion and also with our conservative views pertaining to politics. But I don't traffic in these politics, and not everybody who listens to our show is conservative in their political views too. I know that. And so what I like to do is more traffic in the ideas than in the politics proper. I don't watch the news or read papers because this is the absolutely worst way to get your information about anything. And this circumstance right now that's been in the papers the last couple of days and in the news and gobbled up a lot of attention is an excellent case in point. There is so much misinformation that is being peddled with regards to this thing, even in the standard press. And I can't give you a tally here, but some others have reflected on it. And you can ask yourself, of the press reports that you have seen, do you feel that there has been any sense of even-handedness about how the views are represented that are opposing each other here? Apparently, the state of Indiana, maybe last week, passed a law signed into law by the governor there, a Religious Freedom Restoration Act. That's an RFRA. Notice how I said that is an RFRA, not the RFRA. There are all kinds of RFRAs virtually identical to this that have been passed in states around the country and in the federal government. So this is just another one of those things, which I mentioned last week. It seems that we shouldn't have a need for. We shouldn't have to have an act that restores our religious freedom. Religious Freedom Restoration Act. I thought our religious freedoms were guaranteed by the First Amendment, but apparently not. And so now we have to have extra laws to secure liberty of conscience. Now, when this was passed last week, and I had seen it in headlines on Friday, and I was quickly scanning through the front page to see if there was any characterization of the bill at all, other than it was an anti-gay bill. Apparently, most of the coverage characterizes it as an anti-gay bill, but it has the word religious freedom in scare quotes. The so-called religious freedom bill, which is really an anti-gay bill. Gee, you know, from what I understand, you could read that whole bill through and you're never going to get any impression this has anything to do with the gays. I haven't read the bill, but I know that it is virtually identical to the federal statute that was signed into law in 1993 by Bill Clinton. How about that? It passed 97-3 in the Senate, by the way. And both the federal and Indiana laws require courts to administer a balancing test when reviewing cases that implicate the free exercise of religion. This from the Wall Street Journal. So there's a little characterization of the details here. So these laws are meant to give religious folk their day in court, some grounds on which they can argue that their religious conscience has been interfered with. It's no guarantee. It certainly isn't carte blanche to say, no to gay people, sit in the back of the bus. You can't shop in my store. Who does that? Now, I suspect most of you, my listeners, are, maybe I should just say religious conservatives. I don't mean conservative politically, but religiously conservative. There's a range of political beliefs that follow from that, but religious conservatives. So you just, I just want you to, which I suspect means that most of you believe what the Bible says about homosexuality, and it says it unambiguously. I'm not going to get into that fight right now because it's silly. It's crystal clear. All right. So even though, think of your circles. Do you know anybody who is deeply committed to the biblical ethic on this issue, for whom it would even cross their mind to say to a gay patron, get out of my store. I will not sell you a flower. I will not bake you a cupcake. I will not serve you. I can honestly say I have never met anyone. I don't think anyone, now that I think, I was going to say of my religious persuasion or conviction, that would do such a thing, has suggested such a thing. It's just not on the charts, although this is the way this bill is being characterized. This is about something else. And as the Wall Street Journal puts it, individuals must show that their religious liberty has been substantially burdened, and the government must demonstrate its actions represent the least restrictive means to achieve a compelling state interest. Indiana's law adds a provision that offers a potential religious defense in private disputes, but then four federal appellate circuit courts have also interpreted the federal statute to apply to private disputes. There is nothing new here, in other words. This is just a reassertion of long-standing First Amendment protections. I mentioned, I think, that 19 states, and I was really surprised to see this, in addition to the federal statute, 19 states have already, passed copycat legislation, including Rhode Island, Illinois, and Connecticut. Indeed, I was just talking to Amy Hall, and she said that Connecticut's Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or version of it, is even more restrictive than Indiana. So where is the Connecticut governor getting, where's he getting off declaring war on Indiana, another state? I'm speaking metaphorically here, of course. In February, the Wall Street Journal article goes on to say, 16 prominent First Amendment scholars, some of whom support same-sex marriage, backed Indiana's legislation. He writes, the claim is that this would empower, say, florists or wedding photographers to refuse to work a gay wedding or on religious grounds, but under the RFRA test, such a commercial vendor would still have to prove that his religious convictions were substantially burdened. Like I said, it gives them a day in court for religious liberties that ought to be covered adequately by the First Amendment, but now are being threatened. So now there's a more explicit statement to restore that liberty. I don't know who wrote this Wall Street Journal piece. I'm looking for the author. The title of the piece, by the way, is called The New Intolerance. And I am sorry, I can't see the... But he or she writes, the paradox is that even as America has become more tolerant of gays, many activists and liberals have become ever more intolerant of anyone who might hold more traditional cultural or religious views. And references the CEO of Mozilla run out of the company because he had given money to the California referendum opposing same-sex marriage. by that standard, let's see. Oh, let me back up for a second. Here is Hillary Clinton, who tweeted, "Sad, this new Indiana law can happen in America today. We shouldn't discriminate against people because of who they love." Well, according to this author, Mrs. Clinton discriminated against gays because she opposed gay marriage until March 2013. This is his language, gay marriage, not mine. I don't use the term, but I'm quoting him. It's same-sex marriage. But just 2 years ago, she was against same-sex marriage. So essentially, can I paraphrase Mrs. Clinton on this one? Sad that in America today, people believe the way I did 2 years ago. Sad. Now, let's see. Douglas Laycock, University of Virginia law professor, supporter of gay marriage, but supports Indiana's RFRA because it has nothing to do with discriminating against gay people, but rather defending religious liberty. And here's what he says. So what kinds of cases are RFRAs really about? They're about churches feeding the homeless. Oh, why would that be a problem? Because some local codes are restrictive in this regard, and maybe that you don't have the right, you know, facilities for serving food. And so this is meant to give the churches a kind of a religious pass on some of those restrictions so they can feed the homeless. He continues, sometimes the city or the neighbors object to feeding the homeless. They're about Muslim women wearing scarves or veils. They're about Amish buggies, which apart from these kinds of legislation, RFRAs, they may have to obey all the same traffic laws as automobiles, which is silly. They're about Sabbath observers. They're about church bells. They're about the unexpected ways in which a great diversity of religious practices come into conflict with a great diversity of laws and regulations. And usually, he writes, the government wins. These laws have been under-enforced, not over-enforced. So if that's what it's really about, and pro-same-sex marriage law professor Douglas Laycock says that's what it's really about, why the obfuscation in the confusion in the press across the board here, almost? Here's what he says. Most of the activists in this fight on both sides want liberty and justice only for their side. They want to crush the other side. Now, I'm quoting accurately what he said, but I think he's mistaken. I don't think the right wants liberty and justice just for their side and is trying to crush the other side. There is no evidence to that effect. All of the actions, the work of the judges, the work of the press, the universities, is just from the other side. I just want you to see what's going on. It isn't one side bullying the other. It is one side bullying, period. And at first I was tempted to say this is not about intolerance and bigotry, and then I realized it really is. It's about their intolerance and their bigotry, not willing to give one single inch to the other side. What's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine too. So I just want you to see something here, and I've mentioned this many, many times. Everybody is discriminating here. There is going to be a discrimination of some sort as a result of the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts. Somebody's going to get their way, and sometimes it's religious freedom that's going to win. Rarely does, but they're going to win. Okay. Now, in response to the possibility that religious freedom can win, there are a whole bunch of people on the left that are now currently discriminating against Indiana, just like they discriminated against the Boy Scouts. you guys discriminated against gays in leadership in your group, fine. We're going to run you out of town. We're going to cut you off. We're going to discriminate against you. Now, which side has demonstrated the more vicious discrimination in that dispute? I mean, this, it's obvious, right? Everybody's discriminating. In every single one of these cases, somebody's going to discriminate. Somebody's going to make a discriminating decision. And second, as I pointed out, this is about bigotry and intolerance. Theirs. And the third thing, get used to it. This is just another step as the left wants to take more and more control of your freedoms and your thinking, especially with regards to religion. Because for them, there is absolutely no room in their world for their worldview for anyone else but themselves. They tolerate everyone who thinks exactly like they do. And I recognize this immediately as spiritual warfare. Because these are not just random clashes that are going on. This is a battle in the world of ideas. And I've been convinced for a long time that it is in the area of ideas that the spiritual battle is the most intense. And this is why when Paul said, put on your spiritual armor, the very first element of spiritual armor was girding your loins with what? You know it, right? Girding your loins with truth. This is why when Paul was talking about our spiritual weaponry in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, he says the battle how did he put it? The weapons of our warfare are divinely powerful for the destruction of fortresses. What kind of fortresses is he referring to? He says we are tearing down speculations. What's a speculation? Like a theory? We are tearing down speculative theories and every lofty thing raised up against the knowledge of God, and we're taking every thought captive to the obedience of Christ. And I don't think he's talking about keeping your thoughts pure there, although that's important. I think he's talking about keeping your thoughts accurate. Belt of truth. Tearing down speculations. Going after the false ideas, what he calls it, doctrines of demons in other places. This is just one of them. And this is a doctrine promoted by people who will not countenance any discussion or debate on this. This is why you try to enter in a discussion on it, and they go after you. They attack you. Bigot. Intolerant, narrow-minded, arrogant bigot. You notice that they've changed the subject, right? You were talking about one thing, and now you're talking about another. You were talking about legislation or policy or morality or religion, and now you're talking about you. They're pounding on you. These people are not against bigotry and intolerance. They are the brokers of it. I'll tell you what they are against. They're against religion. In particular, biblical religion. That is, religion that takes the biblical injunctions seriously, okay? Oh, they're fine with a lot of religious expressions. Oprah Winfrey, Rob Bell, Deepak Chopra, fine. Because they're not in their face on anything. They agree with them on all these things. You get somebody who stands with Jesus, it's a different story. This is an attack on Jesus and the worldview that he advanced and that he endorsed with everything he taught through his entire life. He was a Torah observant Jew. And the rest of the record penned by those who followed after him were ones that he personally trained to follow after him. He commissioned to follow after him. So the whole corpus reflects Jesus' view of reality. Old Testament, New Testament. And this is something that this group refuses to countenance. Now, it's fine if they don't want to follow that. That's their own business. But it's more than that. They don't want you to follow it either. Not in any way that has anything to do with anything else in culture. Keep your thoughts to yourself. Keep your money to yourself. Don't spend it on a cause against them. Keep your writings to yourself. Don't write about this. You could lose your job. Keep your convictions to yourself. That's what they're after. All right. All right. Just get used to it. Not complaining, not whining. Just looking at it the way it is and will continue to be for anyone who is faithful. All right. Count the cost. Back in a moment here on Stand to Reason. I'm Greg Kokel.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to idonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273 or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Stand to Reason's new Quick Reference app is now available for free on Apple, Android, and Windows mobile devices. The STR Quick Reference app summarizes the information you need to know about tactics, abortion, and other relevant topics through text and video, equipping you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the most important issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Download the STR Quick Reference app today and be prepared to respond with knowledge, wisdom, and character everywhere you go.
All right, friends, Greg Kokel here, and April 9th through 11th, I'm going to be in Pensacola, Florida. Looking forward to that. J. Warner Wallace will be there with Craig Hazen and the Biola crowd. I got a lot of events. I'm leaving on Wednesday. It'll be a week from tomorrow. Excuse me. And I will be there until the Saturday night and then head back. I'll be in Hanford, California on the 16th. St. Charles, Illinois, the 18th and 19th, big church there. I've been there before twice, and glad to be asked back. I'll be talking about the problem of evil there. And then Barrie, Ontario, Canada, the end of the month, the 24th and the 25th. Just letting you know, if you want to check str.org for more information, you can go str.org/training/events. You'll find Brett and Alan's schedules on the same page, so we might have something within striking distance of you, and you might want to participate in that. So just thought I'd let you know. Let's go to Ryan in Michigan. Ryan, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg.
Hi there.
Greg, I want to, you know, a lot of people call and say that you're their spiritual mentor, and you've had a huge impact on their life, and I can only say ditto that 10 times.
Thank you.
You guys have been great for me. A few years ago, I went through a horrible time in my life, and I have a family. I was a youth pastor, and I have a few kids, and my wife divorced me. She had an affair, and I kind of lost. Obviously, I had to resign from my job, and I kind of lost everything. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a letter to you guys, and kind of spilled my guts out, and I wrote the letter over a several-day period.
Yeah.
And it helped me organize my thoughts over what was going on. My then wife had tried to commit suicide, and I had other parties in my family battling the same thing. Mm. And it was a horrible, horrible time for me. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to you guys, and Melinda sent me messages over the course of probably 7-8 months, which meant the world to me. Oh. She let me know you guys were praying for me, and you know, you are forever, ever in my heart. You are my American Idol, your ministry.
I don't sing your that ministry. Well, but thank you. That's really sweet. I do remember the letter, or a letter like that, you know, a long one, and I can't remember the name so much, but I remember reading that, and I'm glad that you're calling back, and you sound like you're on your feet, and things have improved somewhat. So thank you. Thank you for telling me that, and I'm glad we were able to help out.
Thank you, Greg.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Yeah, I'm now remarried. Me and my ex-wife are good friends.
Huh.
We have a good relationship.
She's still alive,
I'm still...
She's still alive.
She is still alive. She did marry the person that she was having an affair with, but having said that, you know, whatever, you know, it happened, and...
Move on.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So, I just thank you guys for praying for me, and you had a tremendous impact on my life. Mm-hmm. But anyways, I was calling today because I caught the end of a interview today with the people who own the cake shop that started this whole debate, and I thought I would call you up and have a unique conversation, but obviously it's not unique at all because I've caught tidbits here and there of your show previously here today, and it seems like every question has been on this. But,
yeah, there have been a few, that's for sure.
I'm like you in the respect that I don't keep up on the news. I don't watch the news. It kind of bums me out a lot of times. So
that's one of the reasons I don't listen. It makes me angry. So I think we're probably better people for... See, people said, well, you're not going to be informed. Well, you're assuming that watching the news gives you the information you need, and that certainly is not clear to me.
No, that's not clear to me either. So this whole situation with the bill and all, I don't know anything about it, really. I did catch the end of the interview, like I was saying today, about the bakery, and I remember you talking about photographers having the same problem as the bakery did.
Right, yeah.
And my problem with this whole thing is that the homosexual agenda is always claiming that we're singling them out. And I really don't feel like they're right on that at all. I think that they take every opportunity to say that we're singling them out, and we're not. In this case with the cake and photography of the weddings and stuff like that, I've given it some thought. And I think that in a large measure, we are singling them out because take that bakery, for example, or a photographer. Now, this narrowing it down to that because the paint a brush over all industries would be too wide.
Mm-hmm.
But the bakery and photographers, they have married tons of people and baked cakes, taking pictures, not tons, but many people who have gotten involved in unsanctioned marriages by God. We know that, I had to do a lot of study and do it because I'm divorced. I am remarried. There's a lot of reasons why you can't be remarried, you know, and I was single for a couple of years. And I did go out. I wanted to get remarried. I love being married. I was married for 15 years. I love it. And I can't tell you how many times when I was on a date, someone said the girl I was dating mentioned to me that she was divorced. She divorced her husband on the basis of she just wasn't happy anymore, or they were in love and they weren't, then they fell out of love. So in my take, I guess they can get divorced, but they're not eligible for remarriage because they don't fall under the biblical ramifications for that. They should, you know, if someone says, hey, I got divorced,
right.
I just wasn't happy anymore,
right. I got
well, then they should wait until, you know, reconciliation takes place.
Mm-hmm.
So this bakery or photographers, they unquestionably bake cakes for those people.
Yeah.
They unquestionably take pictures for those people.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a problem for their conscience at all, it seems. But if you're homosexual, boom, there's the problem. I'm not going to bake a cake for you.
Okay.
I'm not going to take a picture
you.
For you.
Okay, let me respond to this, because this is a really important point, and I'm glad that you brought it up. I think that you have, you know, generally a fair observation, okay? And in fact, when Alan Schliemann is giving his talk about truth and compassion, which is his formula for dealing with homosexuality, he makes a similar kind of point. He says, why don't we treat the homosexual couple just like we treat any other couple? So if there's a same-sex couple that's talking about a new apartment they got, I don't want to, you know, how do we respond to that is the question. And he asked, well, how would you respond if there was another couple who weren't married and got a heterosexual couple and got an apartment together? You know, you wouldn't go, ooh, gosh, I don't want to approve of that. You know, you just kind of flow with it. Why not do the same thing? So there is a sense in which I think you're right that there is a little inconsistency, okay? But here's the most important point here. All the inconsistency does is to show that the Christian is not being consistent and ought to be just as concerned about these other areas as they are about homosexuality. It doesn't give any illegitimacy to their concern about same-sex unions. Do you see what I'm saying?
No, I that's exactly my point, actually. I agree with you 100%. I think that my objection is solely word inconsistent in the fact that if they're going to screen, I mean, for me, I don't know that baking flour and sugar and vanilla is really participating in a ceremony. But if they're going to have the conviction that it is participating in a ceremony, that's fine. We have to respect that conviction of theirs. But I think they should be across the board then interviewing or at least asking questions about everybody.
This is where I'm going to disagree with you. This is the other thing I was going to offer. I don't think we have any obligation to start probing around in people's private lives to find out what the wrong things are that they're doing. When it comes to a same-sex wedding, this thing is right out front. You can see it. It's obvious, all right? You're confronted with this thing, and you are one— is participating in some way in these cases that they think with something that is an offense to God that they don't want to participate in. And wherever they draw the line on their sensitivities, that's up to them. Maybe it wouldn't bother you to do that. You wouldn't see it as an inappropriate complicity, but they do. And I agree with you that they should be allowed to make that distinction. But I don't think that requires them to go and interview everybody and find out what immorality is in other people's lives too that they might consider themselves complicit with in some way if they were baking the cake for that wedding themselves. I think that's an inappropriate intrusion. I think people should have the freedom if they see a couple that, you know, they don't want to be involved in their wedding. They should have the freedom to say no to that too, for the same reasons that you point out. All it does, I think, the appearance of inconsistency, and I'm not sure if it's as thoroughgoing as some people claim, but the appearance of inconsistency makes it a little hard psychologically to take the moral high ground. Easier for the other parties to dismiss us, but it does nothing to diminish our claim to not have to be involved with something that morally offends us. Maybe other things should morally offend us too, but just because we are not so vigilant on those other things you mentioned doesn't mean we don't have a legitimate claim in this particular case. And that's what I want to be careful of, okay? Sometimes these details are not available to the wedding planner, and there's no reason for them to start probing. You know, wait a minute, were you living together before you got married? I don't know, you know, that kind of thing. But in this other case, it's a big deal. And there, the other dynamic, and I've mentioned this already, is the bullying that's going on with regards to this, the bullying from the other side. And the best way to deal with a bully is to stand up to him. And since we're getting bullied from the left on the homosexual issue, even if we're not entirely consistent with regards to morality in other areas, it's a good idea strategically to stand up to this nonsense, or we're going to get more of it. So I have mixed feelings about the assessment you offered. I agree that there's some level of inconsistency, but I don't think, and maybe we do agree on this. I'm not sure, but I think it should undermine the claim that they have regarding same-sex marriage.
I think we agree. I just, when they're battle line, their battle cry is they don't want to be a participant of the marriage. And
yeah,
so when
the
I
ceremony,
when I,
right.
To marriage, yeah, the ceremony. So when I got married, I went to my pastor and I asked him to marry us. So he had questions because he was about to be a part of the ceremony.
Correct.
Now obviously he wasn't baking the cake, he was the one marrying us.
But it's the same situation. I would feel the same way. Is this a Christian marrying a non-Christian? No way. I'm not going to do that. I'm a licensed minister. I can marry and bury, I guess. I've only married one person, and I've been the officiating minister for one person, my best friend Mike Koval and his wife Sue. But I haven't buried anybody. Well, I guess I kind of buried my grandfather. But the point is that those moral considerations apply to me as a licensed minister, too. And if there were a Christian and a non-Christian, I wouldn't participate because it would be a violation of my conscience, just like it would be a violation of my conscience to marry same-sex couple.
Yeah, and that's where I just kind of feel like if you're gonna discriminate, I don't want to use that word, but if you're going to say no to the same-sex couple, then you might want to say no to the couple who shouldn't, is getting married, obviously, unsanctioned by God.
Yeah,
but
maybe or maybe not. Right. I don't mind the word discrimination. I think it is a discrimination. I don't think the word's a dirty word. It used to be discriminating tastes was a virtue. we're making assessments and we're deciding for one thing and against another. That's a discrimination. It's just that there are legitimate discriminations and illicit ones. Now the word is a dirty word, and all they got to say is discriminate. And that's it. I mean, that's how the guy lost his job there in Atlanta, the fire chief, because
that's horrible.
I think the mayor said something, I will not have anybody on my staff who discriminates.
Well, he discriminated.
Well, he discriminated against the fire chief, that's for sure. He fired him. But as far as I could tell, there's no evidence that the fire chief was discriminating against anybody. All he did was express a moral point of view in his writing about homosexuality. So anyway, okay, Ryan, thanks for the back and forth here. And
Greg,
I'm so glad that we've had a role in your life.
I appreciate it, Greg.
Okay, all the best to you, buddy.
All right.
All right, bye-bye now. It's great to get feedback like that. Listen, time for a break, and then we'll come back with Terrence in Maryland and more of your calls here. 855-243-9975 is the number for the record. You'd have to call in during the live show, of course, and that is Tuesdays from 4 until 7 Los Angeles time. I'm Greg Kokel. Stay with us for the final segment of this hour.
You can take STR with you through our apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen live to STR's weekly webcast, to podcast archives by all of our STR speakers, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letters, and much, much more. You'll have STR resources at your fingertips in a clean layout with great features and functionality. It's free, so download the app today through iTunes or the Android market and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Would you like brief, easily digestible answers to some of the challenges you face as a Christian ambassador? Well, that's why we created our Ambassador's Guide series of booklets. Each volume in this series is designed to equip you with the practical tools you need to understand a topic or area of concern confronting Christians today. With these booklets, you'll receive concise and approachable guides to various philosophies like pluralism and postmodernism, world religions such as Islam and Mormonism, even strategies on how to answer the challenges of the new atheists. To order a booklet from the Ambassador's Guide series, visit our online store at str.org or call 800-2-REASON.
Greg Kokel back with you here, giving you a piece of my mind. It almost sounds like a line from a song, giving you a piece of my mind. Goes with that music in the background. With you every Tuesday, live from 4 until 7, as I said last segment. Let's see, Terrence in Maryland. Let's find your button here. Terrence, welcome. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, sir.
Good. Can I ask a quick question before I ask my main question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Have you ever thought about categorizing your Q&A audio by topic? And here's what I mean by that. I mean, you probably have taken over the past several months, you know, maybe 50 calls on homosexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes when I want to hear something about it, you know, I have to go from podcast to podcast.
Yeah.
Where stuff is. But
well,
I can just...
I don't know if we've we have thought about how better to characterize these podcasts to make it easier to move around between calls, and maybe have each call its own segment, or have the hours broken. I think we already have that. If you get the enhanced, you get the hours broken up. No, we don't do that anymore. Okay. Anyway, we've talked about that. Hold on. Oh, Apple doesn't allow. Why does Apple have anything to say about it? Doesn't allow the enhanced. Because we're in iTunes. All right. Okay, so we used to break it up in a certain way, like hour by hour with an enhanced, but now Apple and iTunes put the kibosh on it. We just give one product off our line, our website, and off through iTunes. So it kind of has to go out that way. I guess it could be archived on our site. Maybe and we have talked about breaking calls up and maybe having a search feature for calls. But right now we've got, the question is really manpower is the big question right now. So that would be easier for you guys. It's a fair request. I think we're just, we are unique in the sense that we have we have a much bigger footprint kind of in terms of what we do, than our staff size suggests.
Okay.
That means we're making a big bang for our small buck, so to speak. Okay,
yeah.
Which is great. So everybody's working hard, and we're doing the best we can. It's a good suggestion. We just can't get to that right now.
Okay.
All righty. So you want to talk about Christians imposing their views on culture or something?
Yeah. So let me give you the context. So I was having a discussion with a friend at work a few months ago about the idea, and it was around the time when Arizona was going through what they were going through with the Religious Freedom Act,
mm-hmm.
And the governor, I guess, eventually came down and said, okay, we're not going to go through with this.
Yeah, because they got threatened just like Indiana's gotten through being threatened.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Backed off.
And so I asked my Christian friend, who's much older than me, probably 30, 40 years older than me, and I asked him, I said, well, you know, do you think that was a good idea? You know, and basically what he told me...
What was a good idea, to back down or to have the legislation in the first place?
To have it in the first place.
Okay.
You know, and what he told me, which made me think, I didn't agree with what he said, but he just made me think. He said that, you know, when you have Christians with their beliefs, or religious people with their beliefs, you know, their beliefs are good inside the home and should be held inside the home. But when you go out into the culture, not everybody's Christian, not everybody's Muslim or Mormon or what have you. So you can't impose your religious sort of beliefs, if you will, on people in the
mm-hmm.
culture. And it took me by surprise because I didn't think I'd hear that from him, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in context of our conversation, I think what he was trying to say was that, you know, homosexuals are people who are pro-gay marriage may not be Christians. So,
yeah.
So if that's the case, then, you know, as a whole, we shouldn't make a law that says that the country shouldn't recognize gay marriage because they think it's right. They think it's okay.
Yeah.
And
there's so much I have to say about this. That kind of response frustrates me to the bottom of my bones, and that's because there's it's so confused and I think misinformed. When a person says they have religious beliefs, you know that the view that we ought not murder is a religious belief. Did you know that?
Yes.
Now, would this? It's a clear case counterexample. Obviously your friend would say, "Well, I do believe in opposing that belief." So, just labeling something a religious belief doesn't tell you anything at all about whether or not it should be the subject of a policy issue. That's the first thing. The second thing is that this discussion is not about us imposing our views on other people. It is about other people imposing their views on us. And those who are conservative on this issue, that means they want to keep things the way they used to be, are the ones on the defensive. People who want to get married, I'm going to just put quotes on it, like so-called married, that is to do all the things that married people do and have all the ceremonies that married people have, can do so, and they've been walking down the aisle for years and years and years and taking honeymoons and setting up housekeeping and living together and having sex together and, in many cases, adopting children together and doing all of those things. So nobody is telling anybody what he can't do. The question in this case is whether it makes sense for the government to license this relationship. And then the question, the way it does for heterosexuals, so the question has to be asked, what is the reason they license heterosexuals? And it just turns out that the reason that they license heterosexuals does not apply to same-sex unions, and therefore, as just strictly speaking as a policy issue, they do not fall under the policy concern. And that is, as a rule, as a group, and by nature, long-term heterosexual monogamous unions give us the next generation. And if they didn't give us the next generation, if families in that particular and unique sense wasn't the foundation of civilization, then the government would care about protecting it and regulating it and privileging it. I mentioned my best friend there whose wedding I did as a minister, Mike Koval. We were tennis partners. We were doubles partners. We competed together as a team for 10 years. And no government agency licensed our relationship because the government had no interest in doing so. When the government steps in, it privileges, it protects, it regulates. It's got to have a reason to do so. It does have that reason with regards to long-term heterosexual unions. It does not with regards to same-sex unions. So same-sex unions don't come up on the radar. They can do whatever they want. We're not forcing our religious views on anybody in this issue. And it's troublesome to me because this is the way it is often mistakenly characterized. And it sounds like your Christian friend has bought that characterization, unfortunately, with regards to same-sex marriage. And and that's why, you know, it befuddles me why that's the case, why a Christian person would do that. I think this idea you can't impose your religious beliefs on other people, that is a secular view. It is not a Christian view, but a lot of Christians have been cowed by it and so socialized to it that it makes sense to them. If I was passing a law, Terrence, that said that your infant child had to be baptized within a week after birth, well, that would be imposing a purely religious notion on you. You know, I don't know what your own convictions are. Would you consider yourself a Christian or not?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Oh, okay, because
yes,
you said yeah. My Christian friend, and I thought, well, you're okay, good. But if you were a secular person, no, and I pass that you have to be baptized in the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, well, that would be a way of imposing my merely religious view on somebody else. But when it comes to things like this, my defense of conjugal marriage and therefore my arguments against same-sex marriage, there's not a word, not a hint of religious conviction expressed in my defense of conjugal marriage. It's entirely a secular case. A religious case could be made on top of the secular case, but I make a secular case. I say this is the way the world is made, male and female, and men and women make babies. And if you don't have men and women, you don't get babies, period. That's reality. That's not religion. Now, why the world is like that, I have a religious explanation for, but I don't have to go there in order to make my case about the nature of reality. So, yeah, just so frustrated to hear that. And your beliefs, this is the same thing people say about abortion. Well, that's your religious belief. Well, what if it is my religious belief? What's in question here is whether a human being is being killed for the wrong reason. So let's talk about whether my religious belief is sound or not. I think it's wrong religiously to kill human beings. It's a matter of fact whether it's a human being being killed in abortion or not. And then it's a moral question whether it's right or wrong to do that. My moral convictions may be grounded in religion. Somebody else's might have the same conviction not grounded in religion. The real issue is, are we killing a human being and is that right? And so this becomes a distraction from talking about the real issue. So, you know, that's why, gosh, when I hear that, I'm not frustrated at you, Terrence, but I'm frustrated that a Christian would make such a view. Yes. Yeah, everybody imposes their views on culture every single time they cast their vote. Every time a legislator legislates something, he is legislating his views and his beliefs and what's more, their moral beliefs. He's forcing his morality on other people because every piece of legislation to be legitimate has to have a moral justification. If that legislation isn't for the public good, and that's a moral term, the use of power for personal benefit, then it's not illicit legislation. It's illicit. So for people then to, you know, pine away sanctimoniously about, well, we shouldn't be forcing our views, you know. Well, look at it. If you don't believe in forcing your beliefs, then get out of the legislation business, for goodness sake, if you're a legislator, or don't vote. Everybody believes in forcing their views, but they want to make an exception if they don't like the view that's being enforced and they can characterize it in religious terms. And then this becomes, you know, an intellectually dishonest way of dismissing something, you know. So anyway, blah, 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 Kokel. All right, your turn. I'm carrying on here.
I guess that's some pushback. You know, one thing I could maybe see as a little bit of pushback is one might say, well, hey, you know, if your convictions weren't informed by your religious views, then you might say, oh, okay, well, I don't agree with gay marriage, for example.
Same-sex marriage.
Because I don't think it's... Oh, same-sex marriage. Mm-hmm. Because it's not good for the culture. But simultaneously, I'm not going to oppose it because I realize that other people might want to do this. And, you know, it might take us...
Okay, so there is a question where you're balancing two competing goods, a good of personal liberty and a good of the salutary effect that one point of view might have on the culture. You think, well, this would be better for culture in one sense, but it's not better for culture in a great enough degree to be saying to somebody else, you can't do this behavior, okay? And so that's a balancing act, and this is where people just have to decide what has more weight for them. But again, subtly you've characterized it as us not letting them do what they want. But nobody's stopping any person from loving any other person or having sex with any other person or having relationships or moving in together or sharing property or anything. Nobody is stopping that. There is no loss of liberty on this issue. They have the liberty. What they don't have is the respect of being treated exactly like a heterosexual couple. But they're not exactly like a heterosexual couple as touches the policy issue, and therefore they should not be treated exactly the same. But this is what their side cannot countenance. They are demanding that every aspect of culture treat same-sex unions exactly like heterosexual unions. And if not, they're going to have a fit and they're going to take the town down. This is a mob action we see going on in Indiana. I mean, regarding the issue in Indiana, it's a mob action. It is bullying. I've already said this. And it's because they will not countenance anybody having another point of view on this. They will not countenance. Nobody's stopping their behaviors. They are demanding respect. They are demanding affirmation. And see, that marriage license gives them affirmation. You know, I don't know so much now because so many states have adopted same-sex marriage. But when you watch when another state in the past, they did this, and then you see people getting interviewed. And they always say the same thing. Now we've got the respect that same heterosexual couples have. Now we are treated exactly the same. Now people are saying you're no different. I heard it time and time and time again. That's what is at stake here. They're not saying now we have new liberties we didn't have before. No, they are talking about the de facto effect of the law to declare by fiat that there is no difference between same-sex unions and heterosexual unions. And the minute that happens, now you got legal precedents to punish anybody who doesn't go along with, who wants to treat the relationships different, like, for example, with adopting children and the like. You know, well, now you got to let same-sex couples adopt. Why not? They are exactly the same, aren't they? That's what the law has actually said. Never mind that children need a mom and a dad, not two dads and not two moms, you know. So that's the dynamic. That's the dynamic going on there, Terrence. So glad for your call, though. It's good talking to you about this. One more hour to go, friends. Stay with me, all right? Looking forward to talking to you on Stand to Reason. Hello, my friends. Greg Kokel here. Stand to Reason's the show. And our final hour. And I am going to tread on dangerous ground here as I open up the show. I mean, all these other things, homosexuality, same-sex marriage, Jesus is the only way, abortion, child's play. Now we're talking about something really dangerous, the Easter Bunny. So we have a call that had come in by Tony in Apex, North Carolina. I wondered, gee, what did I think about this? Or how do we manage this at our home? Well, you know, we got a 10 and a 7, both girls. And question of Santa Claus is kind of wrapped in there. I guess you could say the Tooth Fairy is part of that that unholy trinity. I'll tell you what we do at our home, and Tony's got young kids too, and they're trying to figure out how to navigate this. The Easter Bunny in our home how can I put this? Is causally inert. All right, the Easter Bunny doesn't do anything around Easter for us. Okay. I guess, you know, there are bunnies in the background, and we have our little plastic eggs and baskets. I think there was something for our school that was all set out for. Of course, now it's this. Yeah, that was for the school last week, and now they're back, and the cat was batting those plastic eggs around last night. And so we incorporate things like eggs, plastic eggs with goodies in them, or colored eggs into our Easter. Now, we don't see this as a fertility ritual, and I don't know that there's been any meaningful talk about an Easter Bunny. This is what I mean by it being causally inert, because the Easter Bunny doesn't do anything with regards to Easter for us. It may be just an image. That's it. Now, so Easter Bunnies don't play any role for us, never have. And in a certain sense, well, I guess I'd have to say that Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy actually do play a kind of role, but not the kind of role I think that most people think. That is, we've never told our daughters, we've never affirmed anything about Santa Claus with our daughters. This is something they just pick up from the environment. And then we kind of make very casual reference to. I had a friend who was raised a Christian, and when she found out there was no Santa Claus, thought there was no God either, because the same authority figures in her life had told her about both of them. And that concerned me. And so early on, I think both my wife and I decided we're going to play that card real strong. But at the same time, there was kind of a social cultural richness that some of these icons brought to our lives during these holiday seasons. We just didn't want them to eclipse as icons the things that were really important about those seasons. And as it turns out, the Easter Bunny icon never played a significant role. Santa kind of does stuff around Christmas, right? And so kids think of him as more of an active player, and we've just somewhat passively gone along with that, though never directly affirming that. And that's worked out for us. And I'll tell you, my 10-year-old, when she was 4, she kind of figured things out. No big deal. And same thing with regards to the Tooth Fairy. Although my 7-year-old, ironically, this morning woke up to a little sachet with 8 quarters in it in exchange for the tooth that she lost a couple of days ago. And so the Tooth Fairy has causal powers in our home, although I don't think we've ever directly affirmed the Tooth Fairy's existence. So we're kind of, you know, riding the fence a little bit on that. We don't want to affirm it, but we'll play along with this belief. And my seven has said, hey, mommy or daddy, is there, what's the deal? Is there really a tooth fairy? Is there really? And we've just kind of grinned and whatever. I don't know. We haven't disabused her of that thought, but we haven't tried to encourage it either, other than the fact of exchanging the tooth for some cash. So, I don't know. Some might think that's a compromise. This seems relatively innocent to us, and this will, I'm sure the jig will be up soon for everybody in our household, but I honestly don't see any significant problem with kind of playing along with our daughters a little bit on this in a kind of casual way. So there you have it. Alex, Tony in Apex, North Carolina, I hope that helps. And for the rest of you, if you think I'm wrong, all right. I'm not going to lose any sleep about it. let's go to Edmonton. Would that be Alberta, Ravi?
It is Alberta, and yeah. I think you were here once a while back.
I was just maybe a month ago now.
Were you?
3 weeks ago. Yeah, I was in Calgary.
Again.
I was in Calgary.
Oh, you were in Calgary. Okay.
Right,
okay.
That's it. Wait. Edmonton's in Alberta. Calgary's in Alberta, so I was in your province. Did I get my geography right?
Yeah, Edmonton's in the north, and Calgary's about 3 hours
south of you. That's right. Right. Okay, got it. So what's on your mind, Robbie?
Well, we get a lot of your media up here, and I was glued to the CNN broadcast last night for that hour with Chris Cuomo and just paying attention to what's happening in Indiana.
Uh-huh.
And then thinking about what has happened here with our, I don't know if you're aware, with our Bill 10 that has recently passed with gay-straight alliances.
I don't know it by the number. I know you'll have to tell me what's in it, but I know that you are much more aggressive in Canada on this issue with regards to policy concerns. That is, there's a lot more aggressive enforcement of pro-gay things. And I had heard that somebody in the Western provinces was seeking to pass a law now that was struck me as excessively invasive in private education enterprises, Christian schools and the like, and homeschoolers to make sure that all of those teaching kids in any environment at all were sufficiently, quote unquote, tolerant in their teaching, which means they had to advance pro-gay concepts. And I didn't know the status of that, and maybe that is Bill 10. I'm not sure.
It is the Bill 10, and originally the first draft was allowing the school boards to block, and they're calling it GSAs, gay-straight alliances, and they were allowing school boards to block that. And then there was some debate, and it was put on hold for 3 months. And it looked like they were allowing, especially the Christian schools, which are in the churches,
mm-hmm.
to debate and put their voices forward.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like now, it just kind of recently, they pushed it through, and it's allowing for these alliances in any Alberta school, which I think creates that problem now for our Christian schools,
sure.
where it just takes one person or one student to say, I want to have a club on the property of the school.
Yeah.
And I, in listening yesterday with Indiana, I was thinking about all the things you've taught over the years, and it doesn't seem to matter what our logic or what our thoughtful approach is
right.
when you're just getting steamrolled and you're listening to the questions. I don't know if you watched Chris Cuomo.
I did
yesterday.
Not. So I did not. I was I had been traveling over the weekend, and I had a day off, and I slept in, and I had to prepare for a teaching last night, so I worked on that in the afternoon, and I didn't catch all of that.
You'll be happy, probably, because it would have turned your skin and
yeah.
made you boil inside.
That's why I don't watch that stuff. That's for exactly why I don't watch it.
But I think the issues seem to be similar. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on that. I know the questions when these interviewers, they try to be objective, but the questions are really very biased.
Right.
They're saying, they're using the example, I'm a Christian. I don't believe in, his words, gay marriage, because somebody told me so. What? And then he asked the guest, what's your answer? And it's, there's so many accusations and assumptions in those questions. I just wonder with both of these issues going on in Alberta and Indiana, it's all the same. You know, just a different policy, different law. How are to respond? And what happened here in Alberta?
Were you suggesting a bit ago that they were kind of delaying on this particular paragraph or element, and they're waiting for the Christian schools or the Christian enterprises to step in and weigh in publicly on that, and they didn't? Was that what you meant?
They allowed them to weigh in. Yeah, it was 3 months ago where they were trying to push this through.
Did they weigh in? They did weigh in. Okay,
they
because my understanding of the Christians in Canada is that by and large, they keep their head down and try not to be noticed. And if they don't, and feel like if they don't make a fuss and don't squeak up and don't create a problem, that maybe this will all just go away. Would you say that's a fair characterization, generally speaking, of the Christians in Canada regarding these public policy issues, especially homosexuality?
I think the feeling that I get, I mean, there are people who've spoken up and they've written letters to our MLAs and said we oppose this, but it seems to be that many Christians seem to think it's going to happen anyways. I remember, you know, when the marriage laws passed across the country, Alberta was one that took a great big stand against that with our premier, and even he got steamrolled. So I think the consensus is that people feel like it's going to happen anyways, and there's nothing we can do about it, and our voices aren't heard anyway.
Well, I can see how that would be discouraging. I think that people of conscience on this issue have to speak out, and I've said before that if you let the bullies bully, then they're going to bully more. Okay, and so this is just the way that works. It may be the case that you can't fight City Hall on this one, and they own City Hall, and they're going to get their way. Okay, and so then the question is how do we live within the confines of the new, I want to say restrictions, but to say restrictions is too neutral about it. I want to say that the new bondage, you know, I want to capture the sense of despotism that is reflected in these laws. That again, and I mentioned this earlier in the show. These are not people who have a live and let live attitude. That's not what this is about, though. That's what they make it sound like. And so it's my way or the highway, okay? And so then they want to intimidate people on the right here by saying, well, how did you put the question? Some are against gay marriage, as they put it, because they were told to be against it, or that's what they were taught.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah. Well, and there's a whole bunch that are in favor of same-sex marriage for the same reason. What does that tell us? It tells us something about anthropology. It tells us nothing about same-sex marriage or the propriety of it. So what is it that you really want to know? You want to know the reasons that I'm against? I mean, I'm not talking to you, Ravi. I'm role-playing if I were to answer the person who's given me a question like that, you know. What's the point?
What I really want to know is, like, if we have a case where our church has taken a stand. There is a school a Christian school in the church. They've taken that stand, and they're now saying, we're going to write a letter of non-compliant, saying we're not going to comply with this law.
Yeah.
But it seems to be things are moving forward very quickly, especially in Canada. And my question is, in the end, as you walk through all the steps, and what will happen? We'll say no, we'll fight it, they'll say too bad. Will schools have to be closed down? And what are we as Christians supposed to do? Simply just defend it verbally?
Yes.
It feels like a losing battle.
I do not see, and look at this, advice is cheap here. I'm acknowledging that. It costs me nothing. It costs me nothing right now to say this. But I do not see how a school that is committed to Christian principles can make common cause with homosexuality. I do not see how that is possible. And if it turns out that that in that school they... That the law makes it possible for a club to be formed against the school's wishes. Well, I guess you can't stop the club from being formed. I mean, what can you say? You can't. But what you can do is you can oppose it in principle. You can say, well, if that person wants to start their club, we are not going to lift a single finger to accommodate it. They can start it if they want. We are not going to lift a single finger to accommodate it, and we are going to, in a way appropriate to our convictions, speak against it. So I guess there's a way.
That means we don't allow it. We don't allow a room to be used, such as a classroom in the school, which is, you know, attached to the church. Is that what we do?
It depends. If here's what. And this is where it gets touchy, you know, and we're going to, pardon me? Yeah, that's an example, right. And this is where we're just going to have to, all of us, try to work step by step through these things because we're on a little bit uncharted ground. Now, our brothers and sisters in Christ in times past have covered this ground on other issues. And I think it would be good for us to look into the past and to see how people during the Third Reich, for example, Martin Niemöller and especially Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and how they dealt with these kinds of things. And there's a book that I have at home called Preaching in the Shadow of Hitler, I think. And you see the way that pastors had to deal with the terrible things they were faced with there. Do we close down our churches if we don't sign the Aryan paragraph, you know? And maybe that's what they're going to require us to do, and then we'll be out of business. I think taking counsel from them is a wise course of action when push comes to shove in either of our countries. When it comes to the specific things, like you said, if I were the Christian pastor or the Christian headmaster or whatever of the school, what I'd want to say is you cannot force us, state, to violate our conscience in supporting this, okay?
Right.
If the law says that they are allowed, that they are given the classroom, then I wonder, I mean, a person could say, well, okay, we're not going to give them the classroom, but the law now is requiring the classroom to be used for that. So in a certain sense, it's out of our hands. We are not participating in that. We are being forced to give the classroom for that purpose, but we can speak against it. That is, if it may be the case where a Christian school can say, we will comply with what your law requires, but we will not, because you're forcing us against our will to use a room for that purpose, but we will not be supportive of it, and we will speak against it in a principled way. And so
that's all we can do in a peaceful way, I think.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, you could do in a peaceful way. You could just say, no, we're not going to give that room, even though the law says it, and then have your whole place closed down, or you can suffer a lawsuit that's going to bankrupt the school. And that is happening there, even in Alberta right now. I know the ACSI, ACSI is the Associated Christian Schools International. So I think they have a wing up there, and they're dealing with a school that, and here's what happened. A lesbian woman who is married to another lesbian, they have a child, called the school and said, what is your position on same-sex marriage? And the school said, our position is conjugal marriage. We're not in favor of same-sex marriage. And so this lesbian filed a suit against them because she was offended. I mean, this is the way that human rights court works in Canada. If you're offended, then that's all you need. It's just to be offended. But there are three claimants. The woman who was on the phone, her wife, and the child who wasn't even part of it. But each claimant has a piece of the action. So to answer the charge, the school has to pony up a whole bunch of money just to answer the charge. And if it turns out they lose...
And there wasn't any discriminatory act even completed.
Well, no, exactly right. But it doesn't matter because apparently the way the law is written, you don't have to be guilty of discriminating. You only have to be guilty of offending someone. And how do you know if you're guilty of offending someone? You ask the person who's offended. And you say, are you offended? Yes, I am. Well, then guilty as charged. That's the way that court works, as I understand it. So this is, I mean, it's a total miscarriage of justice. But notice, just to be able to stay in play here, they've got to pony up all this cash that's going to bankrupt the church. Just to answer the charge, it's a frivolous charge, but it doesn't matter. And this is the way these people are going to destroy the educational system.
And that's just another putting the people out of business, just like they're threatening to do in Indiana. It's the same principle behind it, it seems.
That's right. That's exactly right. So this is a vicious enterprise, and I'm just working with you a little bit on what might the parameters be. I don't feel entirely comfortable with the idea of saying, okay, you can have the room because you demand it. You're taking it from us forcibly. That's what you're doing. So we are not cooperating with it. We're going to stand our ground individually. That's feels like a little bit of a concession to me. You know, maybe that's a step. And if you look at, read Bonhoeffer, the biography by Metaxas, and that's you can see the way Dietrich Bonhoeffer tried to maneuver with the state on the Jewish issue. And I think we've got to try to be shrewd in the same way. We don't want to give up liberties. We don't want to be brash. We don't want to be reckless. We don't want to test God by throwing ourselves in harm's way and making God, then demanding that God rescue us. When Paul faced persecution in Antioch, you know, they lowered him over the side of the wall, I think, in a basket. You know, he fled. Flee the persecution. And Jesus said, when you receive persecution in one city, flee to the next. So I think that as a general rule, we are to avoid conflict and avoid the persecution if we possibly can. But when the disciples were told in Acts chapter 4 to stop preaching this message, Peter said, you have to decide whether it's right for us to obey God rather than you, but we cannot stop speaking that which we've seen and heard. So,
right,
you know, some
have to wait till that line comes.
That's right. Well,
but it's coming back.
Yes, it is. And where that precise line is drawn is harder to say. And but it's a line. It's a point. It's an issue. It's a question that Christians from the very beginning have struggled with answering. I think we need to be charitable to our brothers and sisters who maybe not see it just the way we do, but at the same time, I think we have to be careful that we're not opting for something that's painless and faithless at the same time. In other words, we end up not being faithful because of the pain it's going to cause us. That's the other problem.
Okay.
All right.
And I know you got to run right away, but quickly, I just want to ask one final question. Is if I'm a, and they talked about this a lot yesterday, if I'm a business owner in Indiana or in Alberta or anywhere, and I say, yes, by my conscience, by my principle, I don't support same-sex marriage, if I don't want to go attend an event and be a photographer, or I don't want to deliver a cake to that event, we might say that's a little more clear. But as Christians, if we say, I don't want to sell you that cake, is that the same principle, or can you speak quickly as to what it's important?
Well, I would say that is the same principle, but whether or not it's the application is appropriate or not, I don't know. What I mean is that some people may not be comfortable participating actively by bringing all this stuff to the ceremony or whatever, but will still bake the cake if somebody else picks it up, you know.
Okay.
But I think in this case, this is a it's 6-1 – well, I was going to say half a dozen of the other. What I mean is that it strikes me that it's the same in either case, whether they're carrying it to the event or they're cooking it for the event. They should have the liberty to say, you know what, I'm not going there. Look, do you think that a photographer should be obliged to take pictures, to produce pornography for a client who asks for the services?
No.
It seems obvious. So what? Because they have a religious concern about it. So why should they be forced to do it? You know what? I just had a horrid thought. And though this would be obvious, and I think even everybody and every no one would agree that a Christian photographer, should have to make pornographic films for somebody if asked.
Right.
What happens, though, when the subjects of the films are homosexuals? this is the horrid thought. Because now some, you know, you cannot parody this, right? Having just,
right.
I've just spoke it into existence, I'm afraid. Next week, you're going to find somebody was asked to take photographs of same-sex sexuality for some perverse, prurient concern, and the Christian's going to say no, and they're going to get a lawsuit, and they're going to lose because the people were homosexual. I don't know. You heard it here first. It was just like this dark prediction came over me, but who knows?
The situations keep getting more specific, but the principle behind it is all the same. And we, as Christians, have to learn, and I don't know the answer, we have to learn how to answer, how is what we're doing not discrimination? And
well, it is discrimination. My view is, look at Robbie, my view is, let's call it discrimination. It is everybody discriminates in this issue. Everybody in play is seeking to discriminate. The question is which discriminations are defensible. That's discrimination is not a bad word. People are trying to paint our actions in the darkest way possible by calling it discrimination. I'm willing to say it is a discrimination, and what you're seeking to do is discriminate against them. Everybody in play is trying to discriminate. So, listen, I got to run, Robbie.
It's in the way they define it. Okay, thanks, Greg.
Yeah, the question is whether it's legitimate or not, not whether or not it's discrimination, okay? Good talking to you,
thanks,
Robbie.
Thanks for the call. Okay.
Yeah, you're welcome. And got to run to break, and then more calls after this on Stand to Reason.
I have a suggestion for you. Subscribe to STR's monthly publications, Solid Ground and Greg's Mentoring Letter. Just go to str.org and click on the subscription button at the top of the page. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. We'll send you the bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, that Greg Kokel writes on an in-depth subject, free for a year. We'll also send you his bi-monthly mentoring letter that he writes on practical skills you need to be an ambassador for Christ. These are no ordinary newsletters. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ for free. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like why the Bible is reliable, evolution, abortion, timely issues so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador for Christ on key issues you will be challenged on. You can go to str.org, subscribe to the e-news to receive Solid Ground and the mentoring letter.
Each of us as Christian ambassadors faces two daunting challenges when trying to make a difference for Christ. First, how do we initiate conversations about spiritual things in a way that doesn't seem awkward? Second, how do we keep ourselves from getting trapped or overwhelmed by others more aggressive than we are? Well, that's what Greg Kokel can teach you in his book and DVD curriculum on tactics. Greg will teach you how to maneuver in conversations so you can create more productive dialogue with skeptics and challengers. Tactics are practical skills that Greg gives names like Columbo, Suicide, Steamroller, Rhodes Scholar, and more. Tactics are a way of engaging others effectively and winsomely, no matter what the subject. If you're tired of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about what you believe, if you want to increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, then Tactics is for you. Order Tactics in book, DVD, CD, or MP3 format at STR's online store at str.org, or simply give us a call at 800-2-REASON. That's Tactics, a game plan for discussing your Christian convictions.
All righty, friends. Greg Kokel here. Let's see. We've got Chris in Oregon. Let's go back to calls. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Greg.
Welcome to the show, sir.
Thanks very much. If I could, I'd like to share with you that I'm an international airline pilot. And a few years ago, across the North Atlantic, I was kind of sharing with the other pilot I was with some frustration about a cousin who's atheist and I was having trouble with. And he kind of said, hey, that sounds a lot like a guy I was just reading about here. And he pulled out your book and handed it to me and mentioned Steamroller, gave it to me to use for a while. And since then, I've been a strategic partner, a regular listener, podcaster, and actually feel just a little bit smarter, if you don't mind me saying so, because it's things we're thinking about.
Yeah.
And engage in conversation so much more. Well, it's been a long time since I studied this kind of stuff, like college, but it's good to be back at it. And it's,
well, thanks
fun.
For that,
so
Chris.
Thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. And please give my regards to your co-pilot or buddy, if you're still in contact with him. It's great to hear the story that you just shared. I'm glad
well, you had just been in his church in Olympia, I believe, was the connection.
Oh, okay. I have been to Olympia a number of times there in the Seattle area. Okay.
Anyway, thanks for all the resources. You're the go-to place for all my questions, and it's been very helpful raising teenagers with some
super
good information to move them the right direction. College is coming soon, and I'm very nervously thinking about that, but trying to arm them best I can, and you've been a great resource.
Thank you. You know, you might, if they're over 16, you might want to think about Summit Ministries, the summer program they have, two-week program, where kids just go there for 2 weeks in Colorado Springs. They get some really good training to protect them from what they're going to have to face in college. So just I'm just a shout-out there for Summit.
Thank you. Are you still doing the Rethink conference?
Yes, we are doing those. In fact, looks like we're foundational planning right now for both Dallas and Houston this next year. We've got the one in Costa Mesa that we're going to do coming the end of this year, fall time. We've got that on the schedule. So that's just a two-day enterprise and a day and a half. And that's great, you know, but Summit has a fabulous program for 2 weeks. So I like to recommend that to people as well as a resource.
Thank you very much. Well, to my question here, using morality as evidence of God kind of centers on morality as real and also immaterial.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard you use this real and immaterial in reference to numbers before, especially negative numbers, and also thoughts when you ask them what color your mom's dress is.
Yeah.
And it seems like purpose and meaning also fall into that category. But I'm wondering if, like, drive and motivation, that those are kind of that inside stuff that also brings up emotion, and I feel like that can kind of come more from the inside, genetic, or be justified evolutionary.
Mm-hmm.
And when you talk about where you are the way you are because of, one case is God made you this way, another one is I was born this way evolutionary, or society made me this way. And I've heard the discussions you've had on both of those, societal deviations, or society doing it,
right,
seems pretty well tied up.
Yeah.
But the evolutionary side and the made this way seems a little bit trickier when I'm thinking that I personally find joy in self-sacrifice because my great-great-grandmother is that way. That could kind of be something that comes from the inside, not an ought that needs to be justified outside or without using the term good. But also you could say I've got I'm overly motivated to succeed because my dad was always that way. And that's also genetically kind of coming from the inside.
Yeah.
And so separating the inside stuff that evolution can say that clearly came because you are just like dad versus the outside stuff that can't be justified because your dad was that way, or that oughtness where we need to justify it from something outside of ourselves, and is and an ought would be your talk, is kind of my
your issue.
My
okay. This is a little bit complex, and what one wants to be very careful of falling into a genetic fallacy, and that is somehow faulting something based on its origin. For example, it might be the case that I believe in God because I was raised in a culture that influenced me to believe in God, okay? Now, what that tells you is it tells you about your culture. It doesn't tell you anything about God, okay? It might be that I believe that rape is wrong because everybody in my cultural group believes that, and I'm socialized to believe it. But it could also be, regardless of the reason that I believe it, it could also be true that rape is wrong. So what this means is that one's biology can be a functional part in all sorts of states that he has or beliefs that he has, but simply because the biology produced it or plays a role in feeling it does not take away by itself the legitimacy of the thoughts itself. Emotions may be caused by brain states, but the emotion, the felt emotion, well, an emotion is something that's felt. Mm-hmm. An emotion by nature is a feeling. The feeling is not a physical thing. It's a brain state. I mean, I'm sorry, it's a mental state. It's a soulish experience. Feelings, intentions, acts of will, beliefs, thoughts, these are all, regardless of what physical state might be involved in producing these things, all of these things are themselves immaterial by nature. And you know that because they don't have physical qualities. They don't extend in space. They don't have chemistry. They aren't physics. You know, my thoughts are my thoughts. I govern my thoughts, not the laws of physics. So to identify some connection with biological states that may be the result of Darwinian evolution does not mean that these states are not soulish states but are only physical states. Or it doesn't mean even if you have physical states that accompany your beliefs about something, doesn't mean that the beliefs, therefore, are merely produced by physical states and aren't true. They still could be true. In fact, they could be a feature of knowledge. You could know them to be true, even though you have there are physical elements that are attending the mental states themselves, or the beliefs in this case. So that's the first thing that I want you to see, and kind of think of in terms of the issue you're raising. I'm not sure where to go from here because there were so many little ins and outs of what you said. I want to at least lay this foundation. Just because there's a physical thing going on, which physical thing may be accounted for in some measure by evolution, does not mean that there aren't non-physical soulish things going on at the same time. Indeed, even true beliefs that are connected with that. So they're separate things. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So, I mean, you obviously the blue eyes and the tall features are material things that come from dad, let's say.
Yes,
but
that's right.
but the heart and soul of it that is just like dad, you could ground it. Well, grounding is tricky, but I mean, you can say he's just like his dad, and so he behaves that way,
yeah.
And that is more easily explained, I guess. Evolutionary when you walk one against the other, but you can't do it because that kindness doesn't have weight and color. So how could it be evolutionary?
Well,
am I on the right track?
I'm trying to think of which I want to address first. You said that could be explained by evolution. It could be explained by special creation too.
I agree.
You can identify some physical causes of things. You don't even have to talk about evolution at this point. You just say there's a physical cause or there's a physical element that's part of the cause. Okay, so you're just like your dad because maybe you have genes that are the same. How he got the genes, evolution or not, that's a different question. But you have your dad's genes, and so therefore you've got your dad's eyes, you got your dad's hair, you got your dad's height, and you got your dad's drivenness. Well, I don't know if drivenness is something that's biologically determined or genetic, but even if it is, the drivenness, I don't know, it's not clear to me that is itself physical, like blue eyes would be physical. Okay, or height would be physical. You could have a gentle heart because your mom was gentle-hearted, and maybe there was something about the reproduction that produces that. I mean, my view is that reproduction reproduces the whole human being, that is, the body and the soul. So, in principle, there could be some connection soulishly with your parents, almost like a genes of the soul, if you will. I haven't developed this yet, but I don't see why not. I mean, Bach had all kinds of musically talented kids and offspring and grandchildren and stuff like that. And I don't think that proves that it was in his genes, because it's not clear to me that musical talent is genetic as opposed to soulish. But it could be that whatever was soulish for him was passed on into the souls of his children. So there could be a connection there. It doesn't prove evolution. It just means that you could get it from your folks one way or another. Could be physical, could be immaterial. Whether or not evolution is the right explanation for this is determined by a whole different set of criteria, it seems. But what we don't want to do is just say, well, there's a physical explanation, and therefore it's not soulish. Because there's cause and effect, a physical cause for a mental effect doesn't mean the effect itself is physical. There seems to be an interaction between the two. We can identify those things. It might be that, you know, you were born just as nasty as your dad, but that doesn't mean nastiness is okay. Still has moral qualities to it. You know, my dad was angry at life. I'm angry at life. Well, I don't know. Maybe you got it from his genes. Maybe you learned that from his behavior and you picked it up that way. But regardless, nastiness has a moral quality to it. And just because your dad was that way doesn't mean it's right for you to be that way. He was wrong and you were wrong if you do that. You ought to say no to those things and be better, something like that.
Okay.
Make sense?
Yeah, it's good.
Okay.
I'll accept you on.
All right. I appreciate your call, Chris. Let's see. I think we should go to break, and then we'll get to James in California, talk about dreams. And whatever else we have here on Stand to Reason.
At Stand to Reason, we depend on the support of donors to carry on our mission to equip Christian ambassadors, and your non-cash donation items can help. You can transform your old cars, cell phones, or other items into ministry impact by donating them to Stand to Reason. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. To make non-cash donations of all kinds to Stand to Reason, call iDonate at 877-897-4273 or go to iDonate.com and visit STR's page. They'll take care of everything for you and Stand to Reason. Just call them at 877-897-4273. Or visit idonate.com. Thank you very much for making Stand to Reason's work possible.
Stand to Reason's new Quick Reference app is now available for free on Apple, Android, and Windows mobile devices. The STR Quick Reference app summarizes the information you need to know about tactics, abortion, and other relevant topics through text and video, equipping you to engage in thoughtful conversation about the most important issues of life from a classical Christian perspective. Download the STR Quick Reference app today and be prepared to respond with knowledge, wisdom, and character everywhere you go.
All right, friends, final segment here at Stand to Reason. Boy, what a day this has been. Lots of questions, a lot of conversation, primarily about the issue related to the freedom of religion restoration legislation in Indiana. But we've had some other interesting things, too. And here we go with another one from James in California. Hi, James.
How are you, Greg?
All right. Where in California are you, or don't you want to say?
Oh, absolutely. I'm up here in Roseville, California.
Roseville?
Yep.
Where's that? Must be way north?
No, it's actually just north of Sacramento. As a matter of fact, the week I was moving up here about 2 years ago, you were speaking.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't get to see you, but I did get to meet you at CIA in 2013. So.
Oh, okay. All right. But I was up there at that was a great event that Biola put on, and Lee Strobel was there, and I was there, and and some others too. I'm trying to think. It was like Bay something church.
Bayside, yes.
Bayside,
yes, I got a
yeah,
good friend
yeah.
who goes there. And,
okay. Well,
you
I know
you iced me out on that thing, so you made it the week I was moving. So.
Oh, I see. And I had a great time, kind of reconnecting with my high school sweetheart who lives up there. Her and her husband, and they actually took me to lunch afterwards and to the radio to the airport. I had a great time reflecting and reminiscing. They both love the Lord, and it was just fabulous. So, yeah, okay. I think they live in Grass Valley. They live in Grass Valley. That's kind of by
the
way.
Yeah, that's about 30 minutes from here.
Yeah, okay. So what's on your mind today, James?
Well, I got a great friend, and we always get to talking about the Lord on the phone. He's back east where I'm originally from, and we get to, bumping around on different ideas and things. So one day we were talking, and he was saying, wow, he said, it's amazing that as humans that we can actually have dreams. And I started thinking about that. Of course, I've been listening, and Dr. Turk was on a couple of weeks ago, and we were talking about immaterial realities that disprove materialism.
Well, that's right. If there is anything that is immaterial that we can demonstrate is real, then materialism, the view that there are no such immaterial things, is going to be false as a worldview.
Exactly.
Correct.
So I had never heard that talk, even though I like to consider myself kind of well-read and, mm-hmm. and up on things, but I had never heard that talk before, and you talk about everything, and I was like, I never heard Greg talk about that, and I was like, I wonder what his thoughts are on that.
You mean my thoughts on materialism, you mean? Or
Oh, I know what your thoughts on materialism, I think. But just that the dreams as another, quiver in our arrow to shoot.
I think arrow in our quiver.
Yeah, something like that.
That's right. Yes. Okay.
Yes. Thanks for correcting me.
The arrow goes in the quiver, not the quiver in the arrow. I get it, though. That's all right.
I was close. But anyway, I had never thought about that. Then I was talking to my 17-year-old daughter, Jaleesa, that we were talking about it, and she was, I think she was confused with some things, and she was saying, well, Dad, dreams are, dreams are actually in your brain. They happen in your brain. I said, no, honey, they don't. I said, and she had looked at some things apparently online that, looked at the brain's reaction to dreams.
This statement is just, in no disrespect to your daughter, but it is obviously false. It is so patently and obviously and clearly false. But the problem is that people end up saying completely counterintuitive things because some other smart person that they respect said it too.
Yes.
The scientist says that dreams are in your brain. Okay, now here we go. Let me ask a couple of questions. This will kind of lay this out. And to this, I just owe a tremendous debt to J.P. Moreland. I was just talking with Amy Hall during the break, and I said I benefited so much from the philosophy of mind stuff that Dennis or J.P. had tutored me in, and others as well. And it seems like I'm pressing that into service on a regular basis, and this is an example of that. If you were to take the brain, would you say that every single piece of the brain some other person has access to in principle? So I have my brain, but mm-hmm. somebody else could crack my brain open, and every single thing that's in my brain that other person would have access to in principle. Now, he'd kill me in the process, right? But that aside, okay, would you say that's true?
To the physical part of it, yes.
Yeah, okay, and this is something you could ask your daughter. So this would...
I dealt with it in a different way, but I want to hear how you dealt with it.
Okay, and so I say, okay, great. Now, how does the scientist know what your dream is that you say is in your brain? Do they look around and poke around in the gray matter and then see the dream in there? How does even in the experiments that she's reading about, how do the scientists know?
Well, yeah, exactly. They can't.
Somebody's got to tell them. The person who's having the dream has to tell the scientist what the dream is. The scientist cannot figure the dream out for himself because it's not in the brain. Anything in the brain, the scientist can get at.
Exactly.
But even when he's poking you with electrodes, he's got to say, now what are you feeling? Now what are you thinking? Now what are you seeing? Now what are you dreaming? Because dreams are things that people have first-person private access to. So I had a dream last night. I was waking up this morning, and I like dreaming. And, in fact, I don't like when I wake up too quickly and then forget my dreams. I like to lay there and kind of, you know, roll those dreams around in my mind. I try to get back into them in a way. And the dream that I had when I woke up, I was in a classroom at Talbot. And my brother Dave, who lives in Florida, and my brother Mark, who led me to Christ, they were both there in the classroom. Now, when we first became Christians, we were all together in a class together. We were all together in a class, in a class setting in a school called the Jesus Christ Light and Powerhouse. This was a long time ago. But it was really a lot of fun to be together. And then we've been apart ever since in that regard. And there I was. We were together again in a classroom, and it felt good. And I kind of wanted to bask in that feeling a little bit when I woke up. Now, where was my brother? My brothers, where were my brothers and where was that classroom while I was dreaming? I guarantee you it was not in my brain.
Exactly. Yeah, and I approached it with her, and she's 17, so she's figuring this stuff out. And she usually gets it, but I said, honey, if I'm dreaming about planet Jupiter, I said, and it could open my brain,
yeah,
they're not going to find the planet Jupiter in my brain anywhere.
Right.
So, it took me a couple of rounds to explain it to her.
Yeah.
But it was just an interesting topic because, I had never, and I'm always trafficked in these areas, and I had never
thought about that. Yeah. Well, I gave a talk yesterday, last evening, about the inadequacies of naturalism and atheism, and it's called Atheism Bumping into Reality. And the third point that I was making was the inability of naturalism to deal with the human existential condition, that is, the way we know ourselves to be in the inside. And one of the things I pointed out was that we don't talk enough about the soul. We are a soul. We all have it. In fact, the soul is what we are in conscious contact with every waking moment of our life. For people to doubt there's a soul is so odd, because the soul is something you're always in touch with. And when you introspect, you are, in a sense, looking at your soul. When you introspect, you're examining the contents of your soul, and the things that you're reflecting on are not meat. You know, no. It's not brain tissue. It's not C fibers firing on. You're reflecting on your thoughts, your feelings, blah, blah, blah. And even though your brain may be doing things, C fibers firing, etc., still the things that you're noting, knowing, experiencing are not those physical things. It's something that else entirely. And I had the class go through an exercise that I've done before that anybody can use. But it is essentially reproducing the circumstances that you're talking about with your daughter. It's something that a previous caller made reference to, and that is when I said, close your eyes and imagine your mother washing dishes at the sink. Okay, everybody got it? Yeah, okay, fine. What color is the blouse that she's wearing? Okay, and then I poll people. They tell me the color. Okay, so now here's the real question. Where was your mom? Where was that image? Where was that? You saw it. That's what we say. We saw it.
Yes.
In fact, you could reproduce all the sensations of all five senses. You know, you can taste a strawberry. You can feel fur. You can smell a rose. You can hear Beethoven's Fifth. And in fact, when I said you could hear Beethoven's Fifth, I said, "How many just heard it?" Dun, 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 dun. You know, it's right there. Boom, it jumped into their mind. But no machine is going to pick that up, because this is not happening in the physical realm. All of those things were happening in the immaterial space of your soul, if you will.
Yeah.
And if there can't even be in principle a physical location for these things, because they just aren't even physical. This is something you either get or you don't, right?
And without listening to you, like, and Frank Jurek and you guys, well, there was because I had a previous conversation a couple of years with someone, and they were trying to tell me that the brain, that they could tell you what are you going to do by watching your brain, I'm going to call it reactions. I can't remember what you said. And what was interesting is I had listened to Frank Turek right behind that, and he was dealing with that subject, and he said, basically, yeah, they can tell you what the how your brain reacts, but you are the person outside that you're not your brain, basically. So you know, you can think about something, and your brain can react.
Right, and you can stimulate certain areas of the brain, and it produces certain thoughts and everything, and they've got the brain mapped out. The brain, this part deals with this, this part deals with this. How do they know that? I'll tell you how they know that, because they put an electrode there and they did a little stimulation, then they asked the subject what's going on.
Exactly.
And that's how they know, or they stimulate it. And, yeah, that's right. They produce. Now, it's one thing when you know, poke something and your arm jumps. Okay, that's purely physical reaction. All right.
Yes.
But when and you can see the arm jumping even if the person's unconscious. That's third person public. Okay, but when it comes to the contents of your mind, they are first-person private. And the only way that that scientist, that third person, is going to get any information is if the subject reports.
Yeah.
And because the soul is private, and no one has access to that but you. Even if you take a truth serum, right? Well, you still got to talk.
And ask the questions. And I remember, I want to say Frank Turek dealt with it in a way, and I'm going to try to piece it together by memory. He said something like, well, the steering wheel on the car, they can tell every time you turn the steering wheel, the car goes right every time the steering wheel turns right. But there's a person turning the wheel.
Yes, that's right. So if you were locked into your car, people would only see the car moving. And, so there is a connection between the person on the inside and the physical thing on the outside. But that doesn't mean the car is the person and the person is the car.
Exactly.
And that's the point he's making. It's a J.P. Moreland illustration. I imagine a number of people have used it, but it does a good job at telling the story, you know, and letting us, helping us to see that dual role that's interactive there. Good talking to you, James. Nice to end on this note. I have a lot of fun talking about the mind-body problem, especially since it supports Christianity so well, or the Christian worldview that is a non-materialistic view. If there is a soul, then materialism is false. All right, that's it, friends. Thanks so much for your time sharing with me, and I'm glad to share with you as well. Go out and give them heaven this week, all right, friends? I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.
Been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.